ahead now. Sit back now. Relax. Let your mind unwind. Let the cobwebs and fog slip on out of your ears and slide on down your shoulders.
But before we go any further, I want to know how's everybody feeling?
Thank you very kindly, ladies and gentlemen. Right now, we like to slow the tempo down a bit.
Oh, That was the kind of world we'd made. World we'd made. That was the kind of world we'd made. That was the kind of world we'd made. I touch your smile.
Night Shift.
The feeling you're going to have.
He's so squishy.
The place you are.
99.5 FM on your radio dial. If you're drinking.
Or life is like science fiction.
Fiction, fiction, fiction.
During the shift from night to day, the shift.
Night Shift.
The Shift.
My favorite show.
Mondays.
Midnight.
Here.
99.5 FM on your radio dial.
It's invisible, but you can feel it.
We're touching you right now. Feel us touching you.
The name of the show.
Night Shift.
You are tuned to listen to Sponsored Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. This is Night Shift. And I'm here with the imitable, okay, there's no one who can imitate you, really.
Thank you.
Imitable Joe Massiri.
Is that the word of the day?
That is the word of the day. The imitable Joe Massiri.
Thank you.
Has graced us with his presence. Now, since I have, you know, various co-hosts now, I have to introduce you. What are your credits? Who are you?
Oh, come on. I've been doing the show long enough.
I know, but for those who are just tuning in for the first time.
The one pleasure, new listener?
The new listener, yes. Our weekly listener. We get a different person each week because nobody keeps listening.
They're rotating.
You know? Yes, rotating listeners.
To go with the host.
Joe Massiri, so you've still got Fears Mag.
Yes.
And you are the what? Grand Poobah? What is your official?
Co-owner and executive editor.
Co-owner, executive editor of Fears Mag. And what is Fears Mag exactly?
It's science fiction, fantasy, and horror on the web since 1999.
1999.
Mm-hmm. Over 15 years. As we like to say, over 15 years of doing the fright thing.
And they specialize in genre of film reviews and
Interviews, book reviews.
All right, so genre.
Yes.
All like science fiction, horror.
Fantasy, horror.
All right, okay, all that. All right, so now, you saw Furious 7 tonight.
Yes.
What is it? Furious 7. Fast 7?
No, Furious. It's just Furious 7.
Okay, Furious 7. So I did this as well. So we're going to give our review. I have a number of things we're going to talk about. I think Chris is out there. Should I look and see if he's out there? Do you want Chris?
Do I know? Do I care?
Do you need Chris?
Chris? He's very intermittent.
Inimitable? He's inimitable?
No, he's intermittent.
He's intermittent. Chris, are you there, Jared? Chris?
Yes, I'm right here. Sitting here.
Are you intermittent, Chris?
What does that mean, Joe?
Huh? That means like we can pot you up, can pot you down, you get disconnected.
Is that what it is? I thought it was. So he has no control of his intermittent.
He's divergent.
I was going to say Joe is king, but we're going to get down some brass facts. Not even brass tacks. Brass facts.
There it is. First of all, I got to tell you, Joe, I have an interview with Bill Plimpton.
Okay. You were telling me that
great,
this week.
Great Bill Plimpton.
On his new film,
Cheating. He's got a new film called Cheating. And it's an animated film. And he's still one of the few hand-drawn animation film makers out there. He's been Oscar-nominated a number of times. And, occasionally will do a feature. He's most known for his shorts. If you're not a fan, you will instantly become a fan because it's so interesting, so creative, and it's just...
So organic.
It's so organic. It's sort of like Night Shift, you know what I'm saying? It's like a stream of consciousness animation. So, but I have a two-part interview. It's pretty short. This is what I'm giving to you in bites. Then I also have an interview with Dan Fogelman, who's really interesting.
He's a character.
He's a character because he's an actor.
Yes.
But you've interviewed him before?
Yes.
All right, his movie that came out this Friday, Danny Collins, is actually very good. I didn't expect it to be good, but it is very good. Have you seen it?
No, I have not.
All right. And keep in mind, this is the guy who wrote Cars and Tangled and, you know, but he did do Crazy Stupid Love and another film before that. So he's done a number of things. And he's made the transition from animated comedies to this drama.
With Al Pacino.
With Al Pacino.
Is it a musical?
It's not really.
Does it have music in it?
It does because he's a fading like rock star.
Okay,
like, Chris will love it. He's a rock star who's way past his prime.
Where's his Disney Incredibles jacket?
Yeah, it's the whole thing. But he just redoes. He just goes in all these tours and just does the stuff from his one album, you know. But then he gets this letter from 40 years ago. He bought it from a collector. His manager bought it from a collector. It was a letter that was written to him 40 years ago that was never delivered to him because the person who he was, you know, was a record label guy, said, oh, this is a John Lennon letter, and kept it. But it was a letter from John Lennon from 40 years earlier. And when he reads the letter, he's like...
Commit suicide.
Well, no. He of course, rethinks his life. He realized he wouldn't be the burnt out, you know, drug-addled failure that he is today. It's just... Wow. Don't you love the concept, Chris?
Sounds like me.
If you'd only gotten that letter from John Lennon.
No, I recently got a letter from Bob Dylan that he wrote me like 40 years ago.
Did he? And he said, come on over. Because that's what he said to this guy in the movie.
Chris Taylor, what are you doing tonight? Come on over. Let's talk some... I've got this concept album. Why don't you write me back, Chris Taylor?
Elton John?
No, that's
Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan.
Oh, Bob Dylan.
This is Bob Dylan. We're Bob here.
Dylan. How is it? Hey, Joe, man.
Rock out tonight.
Joe, you take Lucindria. You take those pills. You take those special pills every day, that wine pill.
Resveratrol,
numbnuts.
He doesn't take a different day. You take the pill?
I take the pill.
The dollar pill? The pill that costs a dollar?
No, I don't take... I get them from Puritan's Pride.
The pill that costs a dollar.
No, it doesn't cost a dollar.
I know. Well, that's what Chris is going for. He's like, I saw the ad on TV. It's the pill that costs a dollar.
No, I get 150 tablets, 500 milligrams for $18 a bottle.
Really?
That's
how do you feel?
And do you still drink the blood of virgins?
No, that's the blood of infants.
Infants.
How do you feel? Does it make a difference?
Yeah,
he's reversing. He's getting his hair back, and he looks younger.
There you go. My ponytail's longer than your ponytail.
There it is.
Less gray.
He's got no gray.
He says, Mike says you look great.
I see.
There you go. Plus, I have a young daughter who keeps me on the money, as they say.
On the money.
See, because I was one of those, I'm one of those fathers that likes to torment their child, and having done every bad thing, thought of every conceivable bad thing, like she tries to run scams on me, and then I call her out on it, and I'm like, but if I was going to do it, this is what I would do, but you're not smart enough to come up with that. But I've already thought of what you're going to think. How do you do that?
Thought of what you're going to think, and I've outthought
you.
Before you thought it.
Checkmate.
Yes, it is. But checkmate. I haven't lifted my pawn yet, sir. So, yes, I see, Joe.
So, there you go. It
must be interesting being your child. No! What? What you were just about to do.
I saw that look in your eyes.
Exactly. It's like what's that movie with Tom Cruise?
Valkyrie, the greatest film ever made.
Pre-crime. With pre-crime.
Oh,
Minority Report. Right. You know, they're turning into a TV series, right?
Yes. Yeah. They're doing everything to TV series.
Everything is a TV
Monkey
series.
Shines is a TV. They just said they're going to make...
Monkey Shines? Is
not, 12 Monkeys.
No, 12 Monkeys.
And they're doing Brothers Grimm.
Wow.
As a TV series.
Isn't there a show already called Grimm?
Right. But this is going to be a period one. So, there you go.
Hey, Mike, that's because of Game of Thrones. What was it again? What was the exact quote for Valkyrie they used?
Valkyrie?
Extraordinary.
Did they use my quote? I don't even remember that.
Yeah, they're using it now. I just saw it. I saw an ad.
You're full of crap there.
I think for Valkyrie, and it said, It's the greatest movie ever made, Mike Dark.
It is not what it said, and I don't remember even giving a quote for that.
You know, and the other thing, too, is they're running out of titles for stuff. Because, you know, like, the popular TV series, The Walking Dead, they're doing a spin-off series that... They came up finally last week with the title?
What?
Fear the Walking Dead. Yeah.
Wow.
That's like...
They're like...
Bob Kurtzman probably didn't have...
You know what? They had a lot of meetings about that.
There you go.
You can tell they had a lot of meetings about that. They were like, yeah, you know what? Let's give this some thought. But, you know, I do... First of all, I do want to say, Joe, it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
There are a number of things I want to discuss with you. Mm-hmm. I want to discuss the flying car with you. I want to get your thoughts on it. I feel like if there's going to be a flying car, and there are two competing flying cars supposed to come to market in like 2 years, are they going to have new laws, like new flying car laws?
We don't even have drone laws.
Well, no, we will have drone laws. Drone laws are coming. We know that.
But look how long it's taking them.
Well, you see, because it's not a big enough industry yet, okay? It's the same thing. SEC just passed this new law about crowdfunding. You know, so they can tax it a certain way. Hmm. Now, they had to wait till it came, you know, big enough that there's a significant amount of money. It's worth them getting involved. So that's my thought. But you know, some disaster's got to happen. Like I said, I see some stalking disaster. That's my prediction.
They actually did a very good episode on South Park about the drones.
Yes, you did.
So I highly recommend it. Yes, highly recommend it. Seek it out.
Highly recommend it. So there's drones. As a matter of fact, they had drones in this new movie tonight. They had like these amped up drones.
That was the Uber drone. That was like, yes. That was like the Iron Man drone.
And I have to say, the Furious 7 is it Furious 7?
Furious 7.
Furious 7 is like a mishmash of like
it's a 50-year-old. You know what it is?
Everything you love.
It is Dwayne The Rock Johnson's character in that movie.
What do you mean?
Because he's so over the top.
He's
the
great. Daddy. He's
no,
perfect.
But that's good.
Yes.
That he is the summation of that movie.
Well, I agree. I mean, it's part A-Team. It's part Indiana Jones. It's part James Bond.
Hot Wheels. Remember the Hot Wheels animated series?
I knew about it, but I never watched it.
I was, like, looking at it at one point.
And this is the Hot Wheels
like, animated series. Like, when they're
come
to Abu Dhabi, that whole sequence, mm-hmm. It was like, that was like the Hot Wheels team.
There it is. I mean, you know, there it is. It works. Hot Wheels, you know, that's what it could be called, you know. So there it is. There's also a parody of it coming out called Faster. Do you know about that one?
No, I don't.
Yes, I haven't seen it, but if you look it up, there's a parody film coming out also on Friday up against Fear.
Wow.
But I have to say, you know, you can see how they were setting things up for the next three films. You can see, even though they rewrote it and gave it a different kind of ending.
It was a nice homage to Paul Walker.
A very, very nice homage to Paul Walker. It was thoughtful.
Yes.
You know, you could see, there are only a couple spots where I caught, like, the digital Paul.
Yes.
You know, you could catch it.
Or his brother that was CGI.
I can still call it the digital Paul.
Uh-huh.
But the digital Paul, you know, he makes a couple appearances, you know, and you catch it. There's like one part where it's a little spooky where like they just show the same shot. He smiles again and it's like,
the one in the end where they're driving the car.
But for the most part, it was really a lot of fun. The characters are well drawn at this point. It's like a great episode of a TV series. And that's the smart thing about the sequel, and I think what Vin Diesel as
Kurt
a producer,
Russell.
Kurt Russell, he was great.
He was Kurt Russell.
Everybody,
Mr. Nobody.
It's like a mid-age Expendables. It's like they just put everybody in there. Jason Statham's in there, and he's like the bad guy, and it's perfect.
And they even had one character,
Duman Hunsu,
the one character that was fighting Paul Walker. It seemed like something out of Raid and Raid 2.
But of course, also like. To me, that's still the James Bond template, you know. You've got some kind of... Your top henchman is some sort of, you know, freak fighter.
Mm-hmm.
He can protect your ass. So, but I really enjoyed it. And you know, there are definitely some, you know, plot holes you could drive a car through. And a few moments of like, what? Okay. But it was very few.
Self-indulgent, gratuitous... Greasy popcorn in need of a drive and action.
Everything you want in an action movie. Lots of great action sequences.
One-liners.
Some very good one-liners. I really, you know, I was surprised. I didn't expect to enjoy it as much as I did. So, that's part of our review for Furious 7, which comes out Friday. And you are tuned. for listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM. So what's your thought? You don't think we're going to have laws for the... Chris, you don't think they're going to make up new laws for flying cars? Like, what's
I don't even think it's going to really be...
You don't think it'll ever happen? No flying cars?
No.
I think it'll be a while before it trickles down to the general public.
All right, fine. It's not
you
general
might
public.
Have...
It's rich guys. Look, there goes, you know
but people barely drive regular cars as it is. And
you have your private car pilot. Come on.
No, exactly. And chauffeur service.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Someone has said to put in a breathalyzer in all the new cars put out today. Like, if they started putting a breathalyzer in, it would actually probably get rid of drunk driving, or at least a majority of it, or at least.
And I think you're missing the bigger point. Taking into consideration what happened with the Lufthansa flight.
Now that, can I talk to you? Can we talk about that?
But wait, what I'm saying
is,
because
I have stuff to say.
There's enough road rage and people who like do whatever. If you're having a bad day and you've got this flying car and we don't even know how it's going to be powered yet, and you decide
you
want to,
I'm with you on that.
I'm going to drive it into my office.
That's a new level of road
rage. Boom. There you go.
Well, do they go that high? Do they go 25?
Yeah, I guess Susie and HR. Yeah. You
That's
are.
Intense. That's intense.
I'm taking you out, babe.
Flying car road rage.
It's hard enough to regulate the skies as it is. If you start putting, like, crazy people or just people, like, the most people are crazy that are driving as it is.
If you start putting crazy people in flying cars. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's Tom from the Bronx.
Tom, you with the whole flying car thing?
Yeah,
you think there'll
be
new laws?
You wonder something years ago. Do you ever remember What's My Line?
No, but I remember Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
On What's My Line, there was a guy way back. Maybe not in the 1950s or so.
Okay.
Or 59, he had a flying car that he invented. The audience had to pick, you know, who really was the
inventor.
The,
yes,
the inventor.
I remember the show.
And
Kitty Carlisle was on the show.
And he had a flying
car
regular. Back then.
So it still didn't come to market.
Obviously, it never came to market. But I remember, we were just talking about it. I remember seeing
it. It took you back. It took you back, Tom.
Yeah.
Took it back to the 50s. All right, so you don't think that it's going to happen, Joe? You don't think that they'll come to market? You don't
not
think
initially. It'll be a long time. I mean, like I said, I really think that first off, you'll have rich people who'll have them, but of course, they're going to be chauffeured, and then because everybody's going to want to show up to the MTV Music Awards in their flying cars, flying limos.
So it's more of a celebrity thing.
Yes, and they'll have like the stretch flying cars, and they'll be
All right, so here's my thing. Can I just say this about...
Say this thing, Mike.
About...
Make it so.
The Lufthansa flight.
Okay. The Lufthansa, not
Lufthansa. Lufthansa.
Sounds right. Like Luftwaffe.
The Luftwaffe. The Waffle-Wiffer flight. This is what I want to say about the Lufthansa.
Yes.
Isn't it Lufthansa?
Okay. Yes.
Lufthansa flight is that... Okay, let me ask you a question. What kind of policies does an airline have? Like, if you have a pilot... who is having psychiatric treatment, and the doctor is going to prescribe something that makes him incapable of doing his job, they just send a letter to the guy? I mean, this is this guy's life, right?
Well, okay. Mike.
Now, hold on, let me finish.
Well, wait, you're missing...
What?
So you know how art imitates life?
Yes.
What's one of our favorite films of this year so far? The Spanish film.
Oh, I love that movie. Yeah, that was
What
great.
Was the opening sequence?
I loved it.
The opening... It was very prophetic.
It was very
prophetic.
Dark Tales, is it?
Wild Tales. The opening sequence where all those people are on the plane. The
Don't give it away. Because it's a great sequence.
Yes.
Don't give it away.
And
you
so
seen the film.
Maybe the pilot saw it.
But you see, here's my question. Okay.
I read that somewhere that they said that was an issue.
That movie?
Yes. I swear to you, man. I read that.
I didn't read it. They probably related it to the movie.
No, they said a film came out this year. what happens if the pilot saw this? That's what it said.
Oh, what happens? All right. Well, they're just pausing the question. But here's the thing, Joe. Here's my thing. Okay, if I'm a doctor and I'm going to prescribe to you and say, hey, Joe, you can't do your job anymore. All right, I'm going to send you a letter and make sure you show your boss. Like, come on. I don't blame the guy.
But that's not even...
I mean, what the hell?
They're a doctor. They're a patient.
But how
wait,
can
wait,
you
wait.
not have
protocol? How can you not have a protocol that the company has to be sent a letter at the same time?
They had company doctors evaluate the pilots once a year.
Okay.
And it just like...
And so what does it wait? What does that mean? So you see a private doctor and you have a job where your job...
Mike, how many people... See three different doctors. They have their GP.
Doesn't matter.
But the doctors don't even talk to each other.
Listen to me. And I get that.
And the pharmacist is.
Joe, listen. So Joe, here's what I'm saying.
It's indicative.
Here's what I'm saying. I'm saying that's what's ridiculous to me.
Right.
What's ridiculous is that you could have somebody working for you, and then here's my other thought. The other thought is the doctor. Okay. I'm going to prescribe to you something that will make you unable to do your job. Okay. And like, did they have a conversation about it? What's sending the letter? What is that? Like the official letter, and make sure to show this to your boss. I'll show it to you. What kind of psychiatrist are you that you're going to think your patient's cool, who's got depression, is going to be cool with getting somebody to say they can't fly anymore? Chris, help me out here. Is it me?
Chris, you've seen commercials on TV for like Lyrica, right? And it says Lyrica.
I like the name.
Could cause
your life will be like a song.
It could cause severe bouts of depression. If you're having suicidal tendencies, stop taking Lyrica and contact your physician.
Okay, if you're having suicidal, stop taking it.
If you start taking it, then you get lost in the sauce, so to speak.
Listen,
and the problem is
this country is lost in the sauce.
The problem with the medication today is there's, you know, what's in a pill. Like, what are all the additives that's in a pill? They don't ever tell you all the ingredients that are in the pill. So basically, there's medication into your fatty tissues.
Well, that's a different thing, Chris, because every doctor in his office has a formulary. And in the formulary, it's called the physician's like prescribing Bible. And they list all the compounds that are in a pill, from the binding agents.
You can buy that at the
Right.
Guys.
What?
You're talking about the plane, right?
Yes.
We were talking about
the plane. I got a question about the plane, man.
Talk to me.
How fast was that plane going? Because all I saw was like an ashtray on the floor.
It was going 400 miles per hour.
It had fuel. It had just taken off. It was full of fuel.
It was going 400 miles per hour into an
All I saw left was like a little ashtray.
700 miles an hour.
I read it was 400. I read it was 400.
And they're trying to say that nobody knew that it was peaceful at the end. Hey, come on.
There was pandemonium in the end.
It's
like you see the plane going through, you're like, people are screaming at the top of their lungs. I'm surprised like nobody called somebody or texted somebody. We didn't get that message because you didn't have long. You had to get your affairs in order.
10 minutes.
10 minutes of horror. Man.
Listen, but if you want to watch, there's something that a good friend of mine was in this film that was in Tribeca last year, and it just came out on Netflix, and it's called Charlie 30 Zero. And what it is, they actually were able to get flight recorder information of some near misses and some not near misses, and they reenact the scenes in the cockpit. Of what happened at these near and some fatal incidents kind of thing.
That's a bizarre, like a kabuki theater, like black blocks, reenactments.
And there was one that really got me where these guys on this Aeroflot flight are coming in to Peru, Lima, Peru, and their equipment is totally malfunctioning. Like it's telling them their wind speed is zero. And they're talking to the tower, and the tower is, like, reporting what their wind speed is. And then all of a sudden, their equipment comes back online. But then the autopilot takes over, and it's like you're sitting there, and the one co-pilot's looking through the manual, trying to assess the situation, what the protocol is for it and stuff. It's frightening.
The protocol is bend your head down.
And
kiss your ass goodbye.
Your bunghole goodbye.
There it is. You know, so there it is, Joe. I mean, I'm sorry. I just don't understand the lack of protocol for, you know, on both sides. As a physician, you're going to prescribe something that's going to make somebody incapable of doing their job, and you don't consult them. There's no official anything. Come on, that's ridiculous. You know, you send a letter that says you can't do your job anymore.
Mike, we're in the new kind of crazy.
That was the kind of world we'd made.
You know? We'll be right back. You know, it was really weird. They were like, I don't understand what, why they would say this, but they were like, oh, and he was also like trolling like gay sites. Like, what is, why'd they put, why would even, I don't understand why they would even say that.
Because for the, for those who need to see him as a deviant.
Yeah, I'm saying that's really awful. Like, what an awful thing.
I didn't read that part.
This is why they don't let Chris back into the city, because he's been painted as a deviant.
He is a deviant.
Lives in the hole, under the ground.
That's because of the art he looks at.
That
but
too.
Joe, can you get us tickets for like me and Mike to go to like that island with the turtles?
The island with the turtles?
Turtle Island.
Yeah. Like a special place for Mike and I to go.
That was the kind of world we'd made.
You realize what you're saying, Chris, and how
no, Mike, what?
You
no, I
is Mike consenting to go with you?
No. Send Chris. Chris, I'll meet you there.
Mike wants to go to a special place with me. That's what he said.
All right. So wait, let me ask you this.
So the plane departs from Bellevue every day.
Joe.
They give you a nice special white flying jacket.
Oh, come on, Joe, you come with us.
I'm not going with you anywhere.
Now, Joe, you were the first person here on the show to start talking about, it was in the news, but you were talking about the net neutrality laws.
Yes.
And this has been an ongoing process. There's been good, there's been bad, there's been yay, there's been nay.
It's a lot of malarkey.
Now, I want you to look at this, that latest story.
I know.
And please, just give me, you know, you can read that and then give me your thoughts. You know, I want to know about that. I want to know about the cars, the new flying rules for cars.
The net neutrality doesn't neutralize the threat of Mega Comcast. Of course, to quell criticism of its proposed 2011 acquisition of NBC Universal, the company offered a handful of voluntary concessions once the deal was approved. Comcast said about skirting a number of these conditions. Now Comcast is back with another proposed mega merger and is again suggesting that conditions, this time in the form of Federal Communications Commission, FCC, net neutrality rules, will be enough to protect the public interest. Okay, so like I said, and I think Chris will agree with me on this, we were pushing net neutrality in the fact that, hey, we all, you know, nobody should turn around and you know, make the pipe bigger or smaller for companies like Netflix or my website or whatever. But it doesn't stop the companies from controlling the bandwidth for the consumer.
Yes, as a matter of fact, you know, a bunch of these, you know, sign up, $48, all
right.
As soon as you go above a certain amount, your internet, you know, will be slowed down.
Yes.
It's like it's unlimited, but you're not swimming the net, you're paddling the net.
Right. And the other thing is, which Verizon has been using as a sales tool, when you subscribe to Time Warner Cable, they say, well, you can have faster internet download speed. Well, okay, but your upload speed is capped at a certain speed.
Listen to me. You know, and you know what? Let me just, don't even get me going about Time Warner, because they are full of
especially lately.
Of, oh, my God. You know, first of all, they have me on this thing where it's like I'm getting this ridiculous, you know, 1 BPS per second, you know, crappy thing. And then they told me when they sold it to me, and I only have it for online and a phone. I have it for my hot.
You have the internet phone package.
That's the internet phone package. And so, first, and then they're like, oh, we'll upgrade. Oh, you shouldn't have been paying this rate, blah, 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 blah. So we're going to upgrade you free to the premium, you know.
For 2 years, and then you get the new bill, and
this is our new upgrade. And then you get that upgrade, and they're like, oh, well, and I'm like, it doesn't seem any faster. And they're like, well, you know, you could go up to our mega upgrade. And then you look online, and they got the mega upgrade, then they got the mega, mega upgrade, and they got the, this is the best we offer. This is really the best we offer. All right, look, this is it. And it's ridiculous.
But the whole thing is,
it's ridiculous.
That they only guaranteed the speed to the entry point to your building.
You know, they give you the down, but that's the smaller letters. If you look at it, it's got, you know, 580, you know, MHC.
Right.
And underneath it says 10 BAT.
So how much is it costing you? Like, how much does it cost you versus how much does it cost you? How much is your Time Warner bill now, Mike?
Too damn much.
Mine is more than yours.
Too damn much.
Oh, I know, but I don't have cable.
$150, $200.
No, are you kidding? Are you out of your mind? What on earth would I need all that for? No, it's somewhere between.
And now
like
I got to tell you,
like $80 or something.
There's so much. It's become such a Tower of Babel. So I go out and I got this top of the line router that Cisco makes. It's a beautiful thing. Okay? Beautiful thing. All my all my devices that are either hooked in or non-HP work fine. Okay? And I can designate
non-HP. What is HP? What's HP? Hewlett Packard. Okay.
So my sister and Lisa have laptops that are HP. All of a sudden, they'll get on, they'll work for a while, they'll get kicked off. And I'm like, what the heck is that about? I had to go online and find out in the forums that there's a problem with the hardware installed for the wireless with the Cisco systems because it's a non-Cisco device.
It kicks you out.
It kicks you out. So, and there's a way around it, and I got to fix it. And, you know, I don't want to be Mr. IT.
So, wait a second. You're using, like, a Deep Space Nine unit?
Yes, I have a very good Deep Space Nine. This thing has four antennas on it, Chris. It wires the whole house.
He's got a Bajoran woofer.
Yes, I do.
That's the problem.
It's great. It's great. Everything else is great.
All right, so you don't, Chris, you don't see the cars coming to light. Joe, you don't see the cars coming to light either. You don't see them happening. You don't see it's gonna. You don't
I see them making it. I see it maybe working, but
I mean, it works. It already works.
I know it works. I've seen one, but I mean, it's just I don't see it.
On the Nightshare Facebook page.
You know, yeah, the other thing too is it's look what happened with the Segway.
Right.
The Segway?
There were just certain cities that outlawed them.
The Segway. What's the Segway?
Remember this riding thing?
No.
Is it still around?
Oh, the stupid thing. Yeah,
yeah, like in New Orleans, they do Segway tours of New Orleans.
Yeah, but why did they outlaw them?
Well, they wouldn't. Bloomberg wouldn't let them come into New York. They were illegal.
I remember that.
So, just like the ferrets, but now they're legal again. No, they're not legal again.
Yeah, but what I want to do is come in on one of those with a ferret on my shoulder.
There you go.
And I'd be totally
and
illegal.
And a cockatoo on the other.
Are they illegal too?
Huh? You're going to be like Beretta Ferret, man.
Puma chasing me. My pet puma.
And the crocodiles from the sewer.
All right, so I need to ask, I want to ask an expert about the car thing because I'm curious. So I'm going to call Charles for 5 minutes. Have you met Charles?
Yeah, Charles.
Charles, yes. I'm going to call Charles. Charles said he was going to be there, so.
You're going to call Charles?
I'm about to call Charles. And first of all, you're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, 99.5 FM. The name of the show is Night Shift, and you can like us on Facebook, N-I-T-E-S-H-I-F-T. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nightshift, N-I-T-E-S-H-I-F-T-Z.
Hey, tweet off.
Hey. So, there it is.
Call Charles.
C'est à toi. Faut toujours que tu fasses des choses à la fois.
C'est ma façon d'aimer.
Charles, are you there? Charles Troy.
Yes, I am. Yes.
Hi, Charles. Hold on. Joe is here.
What's happening, Chuck?
Not much. Good to hear from you.
And Chris is here. Chris, are you there?
Charles, how you doing, man? We're both in the same place.
Hey, Chris.
So Charles, here's our debate. I wanted to have you solve this debate here. You know, we're talking about the cars, the flying cars.
Right.
And there are two real competing, you know, cars. And they're saying it's going to come to market in about 2 years. And we speculated, like, who would use it, whether it would be the, you know, celebrities showing up for, you know, the Oscars in their flying car or whatever. And we speculated about the idea that
George Lucas
comes in.
And J.J. Abrams.
When Star Wars opens, they come arrive in a flying car. But anyway, And then we speculated also that it could be something that you rent. You know, you rent, like, your private mm-hmm. flying car, like it's a taxi, and you take that to the premiere or whatever. But the question I have is, or the question I had was, do you think they'll have to create new laws, and what kind of laws? Like, do we have an infrastructure for that? And then the second thing is, they don't believe that they'll ever come to be out in any commercial way. That's what they say. So, two things. What about laws? And two, or maybe more importantly, do you think they'll ever come to market?
Well, I mean, as long as you're talking about stars flying into, the red carpet, as a runway, I mean, Harrison Ford kind of showed that can be kind of a dangerous thing.
Harrison Ford is not going to be on the commercial.
Yeah, he flew the Kessel Run in just a few parsecs.
Yes,
I mean,
he did.
You know, he really should have known better.
Well, let's not forget crash he did, too, so there you go.
There it is.
I mean, so that kind of gets to the entire point of why, I mean, like, the, you know, hurdles that flying cars face other than the technical. Although the technical hurdles that flying cars face are significant. I mean, there's a lot to be said about the idea of a flying car. I mean, just from an aviation point of view. I've talked to scientists about this before, and, you know, they make a very good argument. The argument is this, you know, like, a flight, you know, to one airport from another is really fast, right? But then then wherever you live or wherever you're trying to go is usually another, you know, like, hour or two, you know, away from the airport, you know, that you're spending driving, you know, and that's not counting traffic and whatnot, you know. So you're tacking on all this extra time to your trip. And if you could somehow just fly to, like, a local small airport near where you're trying to go, or even just fly directly to your home, you could immediately cut down that amount of time and fuel that you spent, you know, just sitting, you know, like in the highway, you know, trying to reach your destination. So that's kind of the dream of a flying car from an aviation standpoint. You know, not just the fact that, you know, you're flying in the air and jetsons, but, I mean, just, like, it just makes travel a lot more efficient, you know, for everyone.
But then what you're saying, Charles, we would still be talking about local hubs within smaller communities to service the larger airport.
Or... You're talking about the lack of parking, you know, for these flying cars. You're talking about the lack of areas where they can land that are convenient to everything.
Yeah. So they fly to a local hub and then it converted into a car and then they just drive home or drive to whatever their destination. You know, I mean, they still need some kind of airstrip, but it could be much smaller.
What if there was a program with every port authority in every country had on its roof built some sort of a landing port for flying cars?
Well, I mean, you know, then that becomes a much bigger issue. I mean, just in terms of airspace. You know, I mean, like, you know, like cities, I mean, for very obvious reasons, now have very restricted airspace around cities and,
and,
you know, buildings and whatnot. So that'd be, and if you're talking about licensing, you know, like all these small passenger planes fly here and there, I think in terms of regulation, it'd be a very difficult.
And Charles, you know that you can see this. Some guy gets a little tipsy. Right? Lives in the Maryland, Washington, D.C. area.
Gets a little tipsy. He lives in Poughkeepsie.
And he flies into the White House airspace.
Stop.
And ends up getting shot down because he's Tony had too many cocktails.
Some guy flew into Red Square in Moscow, right? I mean,
is that how that supposed to happen? Is that what happened? Some guy flew into Red Square?
Yeah, I mean, that's in the 90s, right?
Back in the 90s. Just, I thought you were talking the recent explosion. I was
No. Some guy back in the 90s just flew into Red Square, right? I mean, like, I definitely remember
hearing
about that. Like, yeah, you know? And, like, you know, I mean, if radar picked him up, you know, they didn't shoot him down. And, you know, it's not like the Soviets weren't extremely paranoid. So, I mean, these kinds of things just kind of happen.
Oh, he's just Putin. He's had a few too many cocktails again.
it was a flying bear. I mean, like, you know, it was flying on a top lip, you know what I mean? But, you know, I mean.
Vladimir, don't be urinating out of the car in Stalin when you're flying over kind of thing. Don't do this.
Joe, Don't be a fool.
Don't be a fool.
Okay, don't be a fool. All right, so now let me ask you now. The other question is, we were talking about net neutrality. And I just wanted to get your take on net neutrality, because is there a way really to govern? Is there any true net neutrality? And explain it for people who don't really understand, because Chris doesn't understand what net neutrality is, really.
Well, I mean, one way, it's a really complicated subject that a lot of people better than me have done a very good job of boiling down. But it's, you know, whoever is building the road doesn't have the right to kind of, like, you know, pull up tolls that specifically target other people, you know, for instance, if it was Indiana, for instance, like, you know, like, if I was running the Indiana road, I wouldn't say, okay, everyone else, you know, get to travel this road for free, but gay people, you know, or whoever else I want to target, you know, I should pay double or, you know, like, or 1,000 times extra, and essentially be priced out of service.
Let me ask you, Charles, you know, like, in every house we have our gas meters, we have our electric meters, so that we can, you know, they can monitor the usage and the speed kind of thing. So if they're going to treat it as a utility, is there any way that the government or even a local government can monitor how, because, you know, the new laws, they said they want to treat it as a utility. Can they monitor the way the utility is being distributed and consumed by the public so that they could bring a case?
Well, I mean, the internet, like, isn't just quite a utility. It's also, like, you know, kind of falls under the space of a commons.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, just like spectrum, like, you know, any wireless spectrum or whatnot. And so because of the commons, I mean, the government, you know, has potentially a lot more leeway in terms of regulation, because it's, you know, it's a public resource that should be, you know, available to the people. And that's kind of, I mean, like, if you're getting into, you know, this area, then as a company, you know, I mean, that's basically, I mean, one can make the argument that that's what you're in for, you know. I mean, if you didn't want to get into this, sector, then you shouldn't have had that to deal with. If I was a corporation just bent on maximizing profits, you know, I mean, as, you know, as my shareholders want, I completely understand from the company's point of view why they want to, you know, get, you know, squeeze every, you know, penny out of customers as they could. But the fact is that, like, I mean, there are a lot of legal arguments that suggest that, you know, the internet is a commons and should be treated that way.
No, I know it's a common. And the whole thing, too, is, like, you know, again, coming back to, like, when you have a meter on something, that's like saying, well, we're going to have a protest. Let's say, like, Tiananmen Square, how that went viral through Facebook and stuff. But from the net's point of view of the people that govern it, we're only going to let 100 people come or 500 people come or 1,000 people. You know what I'm saying? So you're controlling the pipeline. So that's like saying, you know, well, we've got a city and we've got all this gas, but in this neighborhood, we're going to, you know, we're going to do in this neighborhood 2 cubic square meters an hour, but in these bigger, you know, more commercially viable areas, we're going to allow 10 cubic.
Lost in the feedback?
I got him back.
I don't know. You cut him off.
No,
Chris, are you there?
I just potted down.
Sort of. I mean, it's like, I can't really hear you. I can kind of hear you.
I think Charles got lost in the feedback.
All right.
It's like you're breaking up. What happened?
We don't know. There was some sort of alien intervention. Something happened.
The FCC, man. They were monitoring.
Is this like something to do with what we're talking about?
I don't know. Is Charles, are you calling back, Charles?
All right.
No, it's not Charles.
Hi, this ain't Charles.
This ain't Charles. No, it ain't.
No, this is Professor Aardvark from California.
Oh, Professor Aardvark. Do you have something clearly you want to add?
What time is it right now in California? Think quick. 1, 2. Up, liar.
Well, ain't nothing. You think you could convince Mike to start watching Game of Thrones?
You know, it's so funny you should say that. I just started watching Game of Thrones. I had started about a year ago, and I stopped. And I just started watching this past weekend. I'm still in first season.
Oh.
And I'm about up to episode,
I'm sorry.
6 or 7.
Yeah, I'm sorry, too.
It's good. I'm with it. I'm into it.
You know, if you want to do a Game of Thrones show, you should have Lisa on it at some point, because she's read all the books.
I read the first book.
She's read all of them. Kind of thing, and she's my commentator.
Well, I have about three. You know, I'm not going to probably going to get through the whole thing. I'll wait till the show is done,
okay,
and then I can watch it and not have to wait. Yes. I don't like to wait. I'm not into the waiting.
I don't blame you.
I went to that with Lost. You know, because I don't watch TV. I was watching Lost. I watched the first season, and I had to wait a year to find out what was in the hatch. You know what I mean? And so I don't want to go through that again.
I have to say, I've become a bin watcher myself.
Yeah, that's the only way to watch it.
It's like,
and I love the seeing how the story, you can see, do so much with the characters and what you understand and all the nuances, and it's a great form of storytelling. It's the closest to novels that there, I think, that there is. Right?
Yes, and there's especially when there's no commercials.
Oh yeah,
well, it's just like
I can't even.
Yeah, no, it's true.
I can't even imagine sitting through. Oh, there commercials on HBO? Or
no, they don't. But like, there've been like some shows like.
Walking Dead.
Well, see, I record that and then I fast forward through.
See, I don't know why. What do you think of Walking Dead, by the way?
I the writing of the internal angst of the characters that have been in there. You know, you talk about PTSD, post traumatic stress syndrome. That whole thing when they came into that town and dealing what they're dealing. Kind of thing. I think they
don't give away stuff.
I'm not. I'm. We're talking about post-traumatic stress. They really captured that, you know, in talking about good science fiction, the verisimilitude, where you turn the mirror and you examine questions in a different light.
You take a look at the human condition. That's
right. And I think they do it brilliantly. I think they have really good writers, and they're not married to. Doing the comics 100%, so they've taken some liberties, and I think it works really well. And the actors are really good, and the writing's really good, and they've got a great cast. So, I mean, some of the stuff have been like jaw-dropping moments for me. I've been like, WTF.
I've been. Somebody wrote an article like the 23 most jaw or 13 most jaw-dropping moments of this past season of Walking Dead.
Mm. It was really, really good. In fact. There, one character in her confrontation with the kid, I was like, damn, that's some stuff that I would do. I totally get where she's coming from.
You're the one who checks
I'm
the child.
Evil.
I know what you're going to do. I've already done it, and I did it better than you, so don't even think about it.
There you go.
Go to bed.
So, but there you go.
Oh, well, there you go.
Like, did you watch Walking... So, did you watch... oh, what's this stupid show? What was the Bryan Cranston show?
Breaking Bad,
yes. So, I want to watch Call Saul, but right. I've already decided, because Netflix carries all that stuff, that I would wait just till that shows up on Netflix and then watch the whole series.
I've watched all the episodes.
And? We're listening to Western music now.
Yeah, it's a little loud. Basically, yeah, you can wait. It took about three. I mean, a lot of people were really into it, but it took like 3 or 4 episodes for it to really get up to its legs. You know, I'm up to episode. We're up to episode last. You know, we have one episode left of the season, but it's all coming together now. You know, it's been really tough for the one actor. Bob Odenkirk to hold it all down. So they've been bringing back some of the other actors and from the you know, Breaking Bad. So it's working itself out. I find it's just taking a little bit for it to get it.
I mean, there's some shows that I want to watch and I've just
wait and watch it all back to back. I think you'll get more out of it.
All right. Charles is coming back.
I'll be back. Okay. Oh wait.
Charles, you're back. Are you back, Charles?
Yes, I am.
So you got consumed by a static. Now, you were making a point, though. You got consumed or subsumed. Was he making a point? Because you asked him the question about can you really actually monitor or is there a way to really control it?
Right. So, like, is there a way, like, even if we put regulations in place and the government says that this is a utility and we should all have a regulated price at a regulated access, mm-hmm. you know, there's really no way to put some kind of meter on it to prove that everyone has equal access to it for what they're paying for.
Well, I mean, like, you could do spot check, you can do regular spot inspections.
Yeah, and that yeah. works great at the airports, too, so, but guns still get in the country, you know what
no,
I mean?
No, I mean, like, it's a completely different thing. I mean, like, you know, people do random inspections of, like, electricity meters and whatnot all the time. I mean, like, you know, you can just, you know, come in on, you know, various access points. I mean, it's just kind of like doing a speed test. You know, you can go to an internet website and do a speed test yourself on your own service.
But
just see what it's like. And but
here's something,
you know,
too, Charles, that we could point out.
What you can do is just go on.
And I think Michael will agree with me. You know, when they talk about infrastructure in certain neighborhoods, okay, especially let's look at Detroit now, which, you know, is going through, there are certain neighborhoods in Detroit that are still in distress because of their minority neighborhoods. And the city doesn't want to invest in it, while in other areas, you know, housing prices have gone up and stuff because of the way it's been regentrified. How do you turn around and then say that, okay, well, everybody has to have equal access to something, but, you know, when you're talking about the infrastructure in order to deliver that service, you know, somebody turns around and says, well, that's not a priority for us right now. You know, how does the government then force them to make that, you know, equal accessibility,
free Wi-Fi for everyone?
What do you think about Google, Charles? I mean, look what they did in St. Louis. Is that?
Let Charles answer one question.
That actually seems like a couple of different arguments that are bundled together, and, you know, it's difficult to entangle. I mean, like, you know, saying that, you know, Detroit has infrastructure problems and then pointing just to one factor or the other, I mean, just seems fatuous to me. I mean, like, it doesn't, I mean, like, you know, it's very easy to lay blame on one side or the other, and I'm not saying that you're wrong, but, I mean, like, that to me seems like the least of Detroit's problems.
I do concur. I think it's at least the problems. I mean, let's put it this way. You know, all technology, after a certain point, after it's been out there, becomes affordable, you know, and becomes accessible to a certain point. They've exhausted all the first money that they can get, you know, and then it becomes something everybody can have a phone, everybody can have a TV, everybody can have a radio, everybody can have a CD player, everybody can have whatever technology it is, color TV, whatever. But the real question, I think, is like what you're saying, is how do we govern? How do we create true neutrality? How do we, you know, constantly, you know, I get even letters, you know, AT&T or whatever it is was, you know, blocking people's, slowing down speeds on people, and they didn't know. And you know, this is what these companies do. This is how they make their money, you know? And you mentioned something earlier, Joe, you know, about, you know, what they should charge, you know, going down the highway. Who's giving the highway analogy? Was that you? Or
was that Charles.
Charles, you were mentioning earlier the highway analogy. And the thing is, you know, in terms of, maybe it comes into corporate ethics, but in terms of monetizing, you know, and making a profit off the internet, this is how you do it. You have to make preference and give people better access and give other people less access and milk these people and let them who don't know any better. I'm not saying you have to, but that's how they do it. That's how it's done. You name an industry.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm definitely pro net neutrality. I mean, I just think that there's always going to be a tension, you know, between profit and, you know, public good.
I agree with you.
I would love the fight to just be over. I mean, just especially because the net neutrality fight seems to be fought, you know, every 2 years. I mean, like, you know, like, one victory is won, and then, like,
industry tries and, you know, like come up with some other strategy and attacking from some other, you know, points in the globe, you know, using that as their, you know, beachhead. And then they try to unleash some legislation. And then, you know, everyone's up in arms, rightfully so, for about a span of about a year or two. And then, like, hopefully, I mean, you know, the history so far has been that, you know, people have, you know, won and again when it comes to net neutrality. And it's terrifying and it's vastly frustrating, but I think that's just the nature of what it's going to be, you know, given the fact that everyone wants, well, or most everyone wants the internet to be a public good, but the fact is that it takes, you know, money.
It takes commerce, right there.
And companies who get into the space, you know, want at least their money back, if not more than their money back. So I just see it as a tension that's just going to go on for the foreseeable future. I mean, like...
That was the kind of world we'd made.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'd be very interested. I mean, like, you know, I want to see what happens with, you know, the baby bells and whatnot. I mean, like, you know, it didn't seem like...
Baby what?
The baby bells.
What's a baby,
you know,
bell?
Like with the telephone industry, you know, I mean,
oh, the
like
baby
it,
bell.
It never seems like the telephone industry gave this much of a problem, you know. I mean, like, you know, like the people running it just seem to say, all right, you know, it's a utility, and they never seem to hike up the price, you know, at the drop of a hat. I mean, like, you know, there was a phone neutrality. I don't remember, you know, there being an issue about phone neutrality.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
but
you know,
net neutrality just seems
that's
to be
because
so much more
there used to be monopoly with the phone company.
Heck, we couldn't have answering machines.
Yeah,
we couldn't own our own phones.
That's true,
kind of thing. But
so, I mean, the industry does evolve, and as commerce and concepts of monetization evolve, so any new commodity, you know, which is essentially what we're talking about. The access is a commodity. Knowledge is a commodity. You know, access to knowledge is a commodity. So it's monetized.
So, you know, what you guys don't see sometimes is, like, where I live, in a lot of the areas, people don't even have internet.
Oh, I know. I have friends who
you
live
know what I mean? Like, I mean, people don't even have, like, they have to go to HughesNet in order to even have, they're still even, they're lucky if they can use dial-up. They have dial-up.
Right.
I mean, and that's the truth. I mean, for, like, miles, for towns, all over the place, all across the United States, people don't have internet. You know, you can drive for an hour and people will have internet, but it'll be, like, you know, dial-up and that's about it. It's like, you know, people talk about free Wi-Fi. It's hilarious. Like, unless you have cable, you know, unless you have cable or a DSL line with Verizon, which is it's scarce in a lot of areas.
Well, it's become less and less. Let's put it like that.
I'm telling you, it's a big deal. I mean, you know, eventually, you know, no one's going to spend any money. Like Time Warner is supposed to come where my area is, but it's like I'd like to see when that's going to happen, you know. And it's like they don't want to spend the money. Who wants to spend the money?
But the other thing you have to consider too is, especially in some areas in like still like upstate New York, where they're still dying for some kind of economic recovery. You know, they're not going to march in there with banners waved to turn around and hook them up, because the realistic situation is that's not a priority in their day-to-day survival ethics.
But here's the catch-22 with that, Joe. It's like, yeah, so if you don't have internet, you think anyone's going to want to move into that community? You don't raise a family without internet. You can't send your kids to school without internet.
I have a friend who's always asking me to come visit. I'm like, you don't have internet. I can't visit you. You have no Wi-Fi. I cannot.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Now I know how to tell Mike he can't come over. Like, I don't have.
So Charles, now let me ask you a question. You're a high tech guy, but you also go places where there is no internet. There are places around the world where you go.
So this is interesting question. I mean, like, so yeah, I definitely potentially go places that don't have internet, just because, you know, it's nice to kind of shift back that mentality. But at the same time, like, all across the developing world, something that you saw a lot of, like in Africa and in China, for instance, you know, you had a lot of places that originally didn't have telephones because, you know, like the infrastructure, setting up telephone lines, cables, and the generators and whatnot that you needed for that, and roads. Made it impossible. But, you know,
then they got cell phones,
you know, and so they managed to leapfrog that the need for that infrastructure. And so a lot of these places were actually more advanced after a certain point than certain parts of the developed world, because they managed to leapfrog certain parts of, you know, of that experience.
And that's an interesting point. Yeah. That's an interesting point. I'm with you.
Yeah, I mean, so when it comes to, you know, whether or not some places get internet as we know it or not, sure, some places we never get internet, you know, but at the same time, who knows? I mean, like Elon Musk and others kind of want to, you know, develop a kind of a satellite, you know, satellite-based internet that would gird the entire planet. And as long as you had the equivalent of some type of satellite phone or maybe even something simpler, you know, given time, you can get the internet from, you know, pretty much, you know, any place that's under the sky, you know? So who knows how that will go in the future.
I score great stuff in an area that doesn't have internet. Like when I go
he's saying though, Chris, is that there are you know, things in place that may change that forever, just like horseshoes became obsolete. You know, there are things in place that may, like, what we know is internet today, what we know is Wi-Fi, the way Wi-Fi is done and everything may change in the future. It may become a part of life. That everybody has some access.
Well,
I
thought it was really interesting.
We're always connected.
I saw a couple of TED Talks.
Yeah.
Where there are even, you know, revolutionary ways of changing the way that the internet is delivered. From the and I'm sure you're aware of these, Charles, the LED lights that broadcast the Wi-Fi signal so that it's even more direct.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thing, and you could have an LED light, so you, like, the service is terrible in here. But you have an LED light, and because you have the LED light, so, and the cool thing that they were talking about is, like, people being able to, like, spy or siphon on stuff. If you're not in the perimeter where that light is that's broadcasting that signal, you can't hack it.
Yeah, but you know what? I have a way around that. I have this aluminum foil hat that I wear.
So you can perceive all.
Oh,
all
yeah.
All
yeah.
I wear that all
the time. That's how I'm receiving you guys. I've got my aluminum
hat. I wear my aluminum hat.
You told me it was your aluminum underwear.
Yeah, I wear that too. So,
listen, that would be great. I would love the aluminum underwear. To be connected. That would be great.
Chris loves the aluminum underwear concept.
No, I love the aluminum hat.
There it is. Well, Charles, I appreciate you. I know that you've got stuff you're doing, but you're positing some very interesting thoughts. And I do want to ask you this. You know, we're talking about the plane crash, you know, just the last thing, get your thoughts on. Talking about the plane crash and the guy who, you know, I don't know how many details, you know, they found, like, this letter was sent from his psychologist saying, you can't fly, and it was torn up. And I'm thinking, like, how come there's no protocol? Like, if you have a pilot, you know, you have a job where you're, you know, your mental stability and you're handling people's lives, shouldn't it be a protocol that if you're having any kind of issues that would impede your ability to work, that they should be notified? And B, what kind of psychologist or psychiatrist prescribes something that makes it so that somebody who's already depressed can't do their job anymore, okay, and just sends them a letter and says, hey, make sure you send this, give this to your boss. Let them know you can no longer work.
Right.
It sounds ludicrous to me. So I mean, there's no protocol for psychiatric evaluation. And it makes me think about the same thing. What it made me think about is the police. You know, we're in a country now, you know, and I'm telling you, as a person of color, a black man, I read day after day after day, literally every day, I could be reading something about police who have shot or killed or beat a young a black person just to death or killed them and or got off from when they did, you know, and they're still working and you know, and had a long history. I was just reading about the guy with the chokehold. Had ridiculous long. I mean, the things that they said that this guy did already and have gotten away with. And I think, and this is how I'm relating it to the pilot thing. Like, human beings, you know, there is a psychological component to being human. And, mm-hmm. and it has to be considered, in my opinion, for the kind of job and the kind of responsibility you have. You know, if you're upholding the law or if you've got people's lives in your hands, you have to be held to a different standard. You know, to me, I feel, you know, our whole thinking of what a police force is has got to be changed. But, you know, people, they have to go mandatory psychological evaluation. It's got to be mandatory.
But you're missing the core.
Well, not for me. It's not the core. No, it is the core for me.
The core flaw of the human condition.
What is the core flaw of the human condition?
We are disconnected from the perception. There are very few people who are tapping
disconnected from the perception
of reality.
From the perception of reality?
We think of ourselves as being these...
The center of the universe.
Unfallible, impenetrable forces of nature. Here's a prime example.
Is this a prime example?
We're talking about what you've illustrated there.
Yeah.
Take it back to individuals who come up with an illness, like we're talking about this pilot. Now, if you have a medical condition... Okay.
Yeah, but keep in mind, I want to get Charles' thoughts
We're talking about how if you've got a medical condition, you've got other underlying conditions, knowledge is power. This is your responsibility. You need to take it upon yourself. You need to learn everything about your condition to totally make sure you're getting the best possible treatment.
Okay.
But there are people who turn around and don't do that. They believe that each doctor in the individual cases of their different ailments that they're going to be treated for are the end-all and begin-all, and there is no communication, like within their brains. There is no communications within the logic center of their brains.
Okay, yeah. I get that, but I mean, you know, we understand human nature.
We don't understand. People don't take responsibility for their actions.
No, of course. Listen to me. That, in my opinion, is a constant and obvious. There wouldn't be automatic urinals if they did. You know what I'm saying? Because people.
Automatic urinals.
Well, because, you know, people should.
I like
it should be
mints.
Basic decency.
I like
you flush
mints.
After yourself. But people don't do it. They have to make it automatic.
They're
because
lazy.
People. Exactly. That's my point. So, yes, people are not inherently going to always do the right thing. Okay?
But
obviously. So to me, that's why you set up laws and protocols.
But it will never change because you can't police everybody and everything. And
Charles,
unless we take responsibility for ourselves.
You better weigh in here because I don't want to have to hurt Joe. You better weigh in here.
Well, I mean, like, all right, when it comes to, you know, like people who fly airplanes or you know, more.
Or police officers.
Or police officers or
don't you think they should be it should be part of that they have to have and undergo on a regular basis.
Now, the reason that, you know, like people have probably, you know, thought that over the years is just how kind of how psychology is often seen as very subjective or even a soft science, you know. And, you know, like, you know, I mean, what kind first you have to create some type of, like, you know, test that you can, like, that everyone would agree on would actually measure the thing that you're hoping that it will measure.
Forget the test.
To get in.
You're talking about to get in, to be a policeman, you're saying have a different kind of test?
No. I mean, if you're talking about, like, science, and you're talking about, like, a fair, impartial thing that's supposed to measure what you're supposed to say. I mean, like, I could just say that guy is completely nuts. Just, you know, because he doesn't look the way I think.
Yeah,
he
but
look.
Joe,
no, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about having mandatory.
But Mike, I know where you're coming from. But here's the thing:
where am I going?
The human condition is like economics.
Wait. Let Joe finish.
Now, let me just have my say. All right. So, all right. Let's take a less controversial attack. All right. Let's talk about truck drivers. All right. Truck drivers who drive for way too long. And they, you know, routinely get into these accidents where they kill themselves and a whole bunch of other people.
Charles,
you just said routinely
get into accidents and kill themselves. If they kill themselves, how could they routinely?
Don't listen to Joe.
Because my mastery of grammar kind of encompassed all truck drivers into these accidents.
As broad generalizations.
So, you know, if you wanted to get into the grammar, edit me incorrectly, you can certainly say that. So, letting me
please
continue
about
that.
Please
interrupt me. I should have interrupted you, Joe.
That's right.
I can continue to do that.
And you know what? He's very.
Whatever I want.
That's right. He is a master swordsman. So watch out, Joe. Go ahead, Charles.
Well, so continuing on. All right. So you have this epidemic really of truck drivers, killing themselves and just mowing people down with their trucks because they're staying up too late, and they have problems keeping their attention, because they haven't had enough sleep. Now, that is a you're not talking about whether or not they're fit for duty or not, whether or not they have some psychological issue. This is just basic attention. And people haven't solved this problem yet. It's something that you can quantify, something that you can just say, all right, this person is, is nodding
off. But you could qualify it. You could come up with rules and protocols. And
people are beginning to do that, but trying to get, trying to get even this far, basic thing has taken decades, but people are talking about technological ways of dealing with it, having them wear some type of cap or having them wear some type of cuff, that measures fatigue poisons, in their bloodstreams, or measures how often they blink their eyes because, they're nodding off, things like that. And, I think, getting someone like a pilot, who often, has had military training, in an Air Force or something like that. I mean, getting them to believe that they should, basically adhere to some set of laws that, based on quantifiable things that you can say, all right, well, after this line, I'm not allowed to fly.
After
this line, I am allowed to fly.
Listen to me, okay.
I mean, they might be able to adhere to that a lot more easily than some shrink that they've never known before in a country that they might not even live in.
Sure.
Because a lot of these pilots fly from one country to another, telling them that they're not allowed to fly. No. These international pilots, it's just a nightmare because you're not just dealing with one country's laws. You're dealing with how many, who knows how many, countries' laws, in the country of residence, country of citizenship. It's just a nightmare.
And then you've got to deal with the other thing, which you've hit the nail on the head, is if you have an airline in a specific country, is the airline a private corporation or is it owned by the government? Because it's owned by the government, they have a separate set of rules than the more stringent rules if it's a private corporation.
To me. Rules, I agree, but there got to be some protocols for psychiatric evaluation when you're a pilot. I mean, there's got to be a protocol for the psychiatrist. I know you don't have to give away, yes, he was raped by his mother when he was a child, but you do need to be able to say, if this person is in especially under your treatment, they're unable to fulfill their job. It should be mandatory that you have to let the job know. You can't expect
But people always scoot the edge. So, in other words, they'll be less
scoot
likely. Everybody scoots the edge.
He said scoot. I don't know what's about scooting.
Scoot.
Skirt, you're standing up. Scoot, you're squatting down.
Yeah. You scoot the edge, man. You know what I'm
Joe
saying.
Chris
everybody always figures out the way to work under the, people that are driving trucks. Everyone always works it to whatever they're managing. You know what I mean? So it's just that's the unfortunate thing. It's what's the honorable thing? You're asking for what's the honorable thing for people to do?
Well, here's my question. Here's my last question for you, Charles.
Oh, yeah.
My last question, because I do believe, rules and is one thing. I think protocols, ways of handling things that really can directly affect people's lives clearly they're going to be doing some things. Somebody's going to be changes are coming. But, coming back to the police thing, and I feel that way because I feel, like I said, we have to rethink what it is to be, what the risks are and what kind of protection they need, for their own protection, the psychological evaluation. But here's my question. Do you think somebody can be cured of prejudice? Is it only life experience? Can you be talked out of it? They have these
mm-hmm.
these, and I hate the term tolerance courses because mm-hmm. I don't really want to be tolerated by anybody. But mm-hmm. Do you think people can be cured of prejudice?
Well, I remember hearing a police officer who actually teaches these courses talk about it, and she went about it, in a very interesting way. Because, again, you know, I mean, like, she's a police officer. She comes from a family of police officers. And she knows that police officers hate listening to this crap. You know, she knows right off the bat, you know, that there's going to be this, you know, kind of resentment and, you know, like...
resistance.
Resistance, right? So she just... All right, so, I mean, and no one likes being told that they're prejudiced, right? So the term that's usually used is bias. You know, everyone's biased. Everyone has a bias or another, you know? I mean, like, you know, they like, you know, less filling or taste great, you know? I mean, like, you know, they like vanilla or chocolate, right? And so that's the way she usually begins talking about it, right? You know, everyone has bias, and sometimes these biases are perfectly rational biases. And then she starts talking. Once she gets people to buy into that, and then there are other biases that you have to learn how to consider, you know? And, you know, once you talk people down from, you know, being told that they're the bad guy and just say, all right, you have these biases, but the point of your job is to overcome these biases and therefore not act in a prejudiced manner. And this has successfully worked in police departments. I mean, or at least successfully in terms of, like, complaints about this kind of thing have gone down, you know, over time. You know, I mean, like, that's how, I mean, it's possible. I mean, like, according to, I mean, reports, I mean, it seems possible to get police to fight their own biases and lead to fewer incidents. I mean, that's the only thing I can hope for, you know, I mean... there's science to back it up, but, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, you're dealing with people, and hopefully it will work.
I hear you. Well, Charles, I thank you. Chris?
Yes.
You have anything you want to ask Charles before he goes?
There was a question about something to do with space.
Mm-hmm. Space? That's a really...
Yes.
Hey, Charles, I have a question for you about space.
They just sent that guy to for a year. What do you think about that? You going to find anything out?
I thought it was 9 months.
No, he's going.
No,
for
he's
year.
Going for a year. A year, right?
And this is going to go.
Is he going to go crazy after 9 months, though?
Well, no, I mean, what's most interesting is the fact that, you know, I mean, they're twin astronauts. I mean, like, you have these two astronauts who are twins.
Avatar, just like an Avatar.
Yeah, you know. It sounds like a great idea, but, I mean, to really learn anything, you need, like, 50 twin astronauts, at least. But, you know, I mean, it's a nice try. You know, maybe they'll find something. Who knows?
And then there was an article today that I sent Mike about this 10th century Anglo-Saxon. They took a medical, some recipe, and they've used it, and supposedly 90% has gotten rid of SARS and superbugs.
Well, you know,
have you seen about that?
I didn't see that, but, you know, I mean,
okay.
That seems a little suspect to me.
Well, look into that, and then the next time you come on, we'll talk about it. But I sent the article to Mike, and it's the latest news just came out, so it's probably why you're not sure about it, Ed, because it's just, I don't know, just the latest in the medical journal came out.
Yeah,
so.
Maybe.
So we'll talk about it.
I'd be suspect myself. I too would be suspect, Charles. All right. Well, Charles, I appreciate it. I appreciate you, and you will be back within the next couple of weeks live.
Most definitely. And great to talk with you guys again.
All right, man. Thank you.
All right.
And you're tuned to listener-sponsored radio WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Night Shift. Next, we got an interview with Dan Fogelman, who is a director of a new film called Danny Collins. We got a chance to talk to him. He's a writer, director, actor. He's written a number of big hit films, animated films, Cars, Tangled, things like that. Then he did Crazy Stupid Love, and he did one other serious film, and he's done this, or one other comedy, and he's done this, which is the most serious film he's done, and this is the first one he's directed. So I got to talk to him about it and, like, what it was like working with, you know, Al Pacino. And so stay tuned to Night Shift.
Q
Hey, tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI, and I'm here with Dan Fogelman, who's the writer and director of the new film, Danny Collins. Dan, welcome to WBAI.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
So, my first question, I want to get some contextual questions with you. When did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
That's a good question. When did I first know? I always had written. I didn't really have a form for it. I thought maybe I'd be a novelist. I studied the novel a lot. Okay. At college, I went to Oxford University studying the Victorian literature and Victorian novels, and now I'm writing Al Pacino movies. But I'd always written, and even in college, I lived with a bunch of like 12 meathead guys. It wasn't a fraternity, but it was the weirdest collection of kind of jocks and nerds, and I would put like little news articles written about the entire house up every morning for the guys to see as they were going about on their day. So okay. I'd always done stuff like that, but never formally.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, second question. Why do you think we as human beings need to tell stories? Every culture has it.
Yeah.
I think the purpose of story is.
First of all, there's two types of stories. There's the portion of them that are allegorical and teach you something, right? And hopefully express something in an artistic form about the human condition without sounding too highfalutin. But I also think I'm a believer that life is incredibly challenging and hard. It's also beautiful, but the day-to-day kind of surviving and raising a family and being in a marriage and working and trying to make a living and pay your bills, all of it is just very hard. And it's hard in America. It's even harder in various other parts of the world. And I think a good story can take you away for 2 hours. For me, it's often what reading did as a young man, is that when I'm most stressed, when I'm most worried about whatever the things are I worry about, I enjoy sitting down and watching a movie and seeing if I can get it to shut my brain off for a little while, or read a book because you're focused on the words and the story. And I think we need that. It's a form, for me, it's a form of meditation, a way of kind of hitting your restart button a little bit. Hmm. The way that some people use exercise or yoga or whatever to kind of clear their brain.
In your estimation, what makes a good story and a story worth telling?
The thing that I've learned in doing a lot of films and doing a lot of movies is that the time commitment that goes into making a film or a TV show, it's years of your life. And so when I sit down to write one or decide I'm really going to go for this one, I go into it knowing, is this a story that I feel is worth years
of life?
And I sometimes have started, I very often do 10 pages of a script, 20 pages of script, and I go, I'm not vibing with this. It's not just the process of writing a 100-page screenplay, because that's not that bad. It's then making it, living with it, being it, your name being on it. So I don't know. At a certain point, you just get to a point in your career where you're like, is it worth the commitment?
Well, you've had a really fascinating career from where I'm sitting, because you started out doing animated films.
Yeah.
But definitely for, I think, the company that does the most story-driven animated films there are.
Yeah.
And you mentioned something, too, that a good story has, you know, some sort of lesson,
yeah,
you know, which all of your stories have. But I'm curious, making the transition, not so much from animation, but from comedy to Danny Collins, is not really a comedy.
No.
It's funny,
yeah,
but it's a drama. So, A, what made you want to come to move out of comedy? And B, what made you decide this was the one to direct?
You know, this is Danny Collins, and to a certain extent, Crazy Stupid Love are the closest I've gotten so far in exactly the type of movie I want to do, and it's been, you come in bits and pieces. I'm proud of all of them, even ones that have been not as well received or done less well at a box office, especially the animation ones. I'm proud of them all. But in terms of when I started kind of figuring out I was going to do this, all right, I'm going to be a screenwriter now, it's happening, and I might even get a chance to direct, I think Danny Collins is the closest I've got into getting exactly the tone of what I want to do, which I guess would be more defined as, yeah, funny drama, or a drama with comedy, or a dramedy, maybe, if you're using words like that. But those are the touchstone movies for me of my youth, were very much this kind of Sidney Pollack into the Jim Brooks, into the Cameron Crowe movies. That it's a tone of movie that's not made that much anymore. And, mm-hmm. and when they are, they often don't get made super well. But they're hard to make, and they're hard to do, and that was always what drove me. The, you know, Kramer versus Kramer, Tootsie, Almost Famous, Jerry Maguire, Say Anything. I don't know how you would define these movies, as good as it gets. You would never call them quite a comedy.
No.
But you wouldn't also, drama seems too severe. Right,
right, right. Right.
And so, I don't know what that term is, but I feel like, for whatever reason, it's almost as if we've stopped valuing, when you talk about the business of the film business, it's like those movies are, we all talk about them with such reverence, but they're not kind of made that much anymore, and they're not valued the same way. You don't see them come November and December around Oscar time, because if it's too sweet or it makes you laugh, it's automatically not a serious film. And if and then other on the other end of the spectrum, you've got really broad, you can do broad romantic comedies, or, but that film that tries to live in the middle ground, like I'm trying to do with this film, those are hard to sell, they're hard to figure out, they're hard to do, they're hard to get financing for, but it seems to be what I dig, so that's my kind of journey right now, is trying to figure out how to do those.
Well, I really, really like the film, and I went into it not knowing.
Yeah.
You know, the premise is like, okay. But I loved it. I thought it had so many things to say about so many things. Yeah. So I'm curious for you in your process. I know myself as a writer, sometimes you start writing something, and then maybe halfway through you realize, I'm writing about this too. Yeah. And then, so was there a process of self-discovery? Like, did you realize you were writing about more than what you thought initially?
I write very fluidly and quickly. Like, I don't map out a lot. And so that's always a bit of the process for me. I kind of know what the idea is, and I know what the ending is going to be. Like, I knew very much immediately upon hearing the story, I knew what the end of the movie was, the final scene. And then it's a matter of like, all right, I'm going to now sit down for 2 weeks in front of my computer. I'm going to start on page one because I know what the start is. And I'm going to find a way to get to that ending, you know, and then I just go.
Okay.
And so there's not a lot of high art to the process I do. I just kind of sit down. I know the beginning. I know the end. And I just kind of try and write until I get to that ending. So it's all a process of discovery a little bit. The hard work comes after, because then you've got kind of, you can have something that's a little unwieldy or unformed, and then in the years that it takes to make a movie is when you're hopefully doing the real shaping and driving. But so yeah, I mean, I knew on this particular film, I knew very much what the movie was going to be about, because I had the context of this real life letter,
right,
and this event, and I knew very much not just what the first scene was, but what the first act was. I knew immediately. And then I knew what I wanted it to be a story about, what I'm the type of movie I'm interested in telling, and I knew what the ending was. So I kind of really quickly knew. I knew it was Al. I wrote it for Al, picturing Al. And I just kind of knew. This one just kind of, I knew what it would look like. I knew what it would sound like. I just felt it. And that's why I felt I needed to direct this one. I felt like it was merging at a time in my life and an age where I now felt ready for it. And I felt like this was the one. I couldn't imagine giving it to somebody else, even if they would make a better movie than I would have made, a worse movie. I just couldn't imagine giving it up.
Well, you also seem like you're a big film fan, too.
Yeah.
Okay, so two questions. A, how quickly or how well did Al respond to this? And B, were you intimidated at all, like you're going to direct Al Pacino in your first film?
The Al portion of it happened really quickly, relatively, like once he was made aware of it. So there was almost not a ton of time to get super intimidated. I sent him the script via however you send Al a script. It was managers or people, producers sent it. And then I kind of got the call that Al liked it and wants you to come to New York and meet him. He was doing Merchant of Venice on Broadway. And so I flew to New York, and that's intense, you know. Like, you're sitting there, you're sweating down your back in New York theater, waiting, and then afterwards, like, Mr. Pacino's going to see you down in his dressing room. And you go down, and you meet Al for the first time. We never met. And we quickly hit it off, and he's like, you wrote this for me. I can tell you wrote this for me. And I said, I did. And then we started, like, a couple of year courtship of just trying to get our schedules to align to make the movie and reading the text an awful lot, finding the financing. So by the time you're actually directing Al Pacino yelling, action, Al, it's much less intimidating than it should be. The intimidating part was going to that theater and finding out if he liked the script or not. After that, he's a really nice man. He's gentle and quiet and soft-spoken and really interesting and curious. And so by the time you're directing, I know I'm young and I haven't done this before and it's Al Pacino and I should be intimidated, but you're strangely not.
Well, a couple things. Last question on casting. I mean, you have a great cast.
Yeah.
I'm a big Christopher Plummer fan.
Yeah.
I thought you got great work out of him. And who really surprised me, not that I thought anything less of him, but was Bobby Cannavale.
He's amazing.
He moved me
in
that movie. And so just talk to me about working with and getting your cast.
It was also surprisingly easy because it was a good script, but Al being attached and kind of supporting me as a first-time director and playing the title role, it just the script reads differently. You know what I mean? Like, to an actor, like, to get supporting performances of Chris Plummer, Annette Bening, Bobby, and Jen all in the same film, I mean, that comes from Al. It's not just a good script. It's not like people are so much clamoring to work with a first-time director who's primarily known for animated films. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like that. So that's really Al. And we got everybody we wanted. I mean, Bobby was the one Al and I always talked about. And, you know, sometimes a question can be, like, Bobby's star is now rising so fast that it's crazy. But when we were kind of putting the movie together, you know, that's arguably, like, the co-second lead in the film. And we just felt, Al and I both, Al loves Bobby. Like, they almost have a father-son relationship in real life. Al is very, very fond of him. And they did Glengarry, Glen Ross together on Broadway. And we just always talked about Bobby. And he's kind of perfect in the movie. I mean, it's funny. It's like, it's alpha, regular man stuff. But it's also, like, heartbreaking and little boy. I just think he's pitch perfect in the film. I think what he and Al do together in the final scene of the movie, it's not me. I don't do anything. It's a two shot of the tank in that final moment.
Now, let me ask you, in terms of, I tend to believe the film is actually directed three times. First time when you write it, you're kind of directing in your head. Second time when you're in set, you're getting what you can. And third time in editing, you literally can create a whole new film. A, do you agree with that? And B, what do you get out of each? What's your favorite?
I 100% agree with that. I mean, it's definitely, and I'd almost argue that the middle portion is, that's all about the actors. That's all about just you, to me, because I'm not doing Birdman. That's not what my skill set is. I don't know how to do that. I wouldn't know how to do that if in a million years I wouldn't be smart enough. The portion on set is about directing. The directing portion is about just casting correctly and then getting out of their way and making sure that you just kind of guide people back if anybody's kind of stepping left of center, you know, in a way that you think is not feeling right. To me, the biggest place is in the edit bay. It really is. I mean, I could make a totally different film with the materials I have. I could make a completely different film if I wanted to, without changing a thing about what we shot. And that's so interesting. I mean, my editor who I worked with is a woman named Julie Monroe, who's very accomplished at a very young age. The movie she had done right before mine was Mud, but she grew up in Oliver Stone's camp, and I mean, she's just amazing. And to me, like, she is the whole film. I always say, like, I've done this for a while now. I've done TV, I've done film. Like, in any category, for any person I've ever worked with on any project, she's the best I've ever worked with. I would wait to do another movie until she was available, because I would go in on the weekends because I wanted to make sure I was doing it right. And that I wasn't, like, kind of screwing up Al's movie. And I would go and check that out on the weekends and edit with her a little bit to make sure, like, because I'm like, if I screwed something up, I want to go get it while I still have Al Pacino in costume. Mm-hmm. And she would bring stuff in, and it would be, like, completely not what I had thought. It was so much better. Honestly, like, that night, I knew what I wanted it to feel like, and I shot it to feel like it felt. But I had no idea how the montage night with Al and Annette Bening was going to come together. And that was just, like, Julie just did that. I mean, I didn't change a frame, I don't think, of it. You know what I mean? And that wasn't the music. It wasn't the song I had pictured for it. Every part of it is all her. And then we had to whittle it down and shape it a little, but, I mean, it was all her. And so, there's so much happens there.
I also feel that as you define your art defines you. What do you learn about yourself in making this project?
You know, the big thing you learn as a first-time director is that you can do it, right? Because it seems overwhelming and daunting. I didn't go to film school, and I didn't know a ton about lenses. And, you know, I had to learn, and I had a great DP. But you learn you can do it. And then it's less overwhelming than you think it is. I don't know. I think with this film, I really defined what I want to be chasing now for the rest of my career, the type of movie I want to make, the type of the level I want to make it at, and how. That was really defining for me. I think it's been pleasing to me to watch audiences respond to the movie. It's been more rewarding than I would care to admit it's been to watch. Early on, the movie seemed to be kind of warmly received, even by kind of often very cynical critics who I were very worried about with this movie. Not because it's not fun. It's not fun when your family reads shitty things about your movie. You know, that's been a pleasant part surprise too, because I'm like, you see, like, you can do a movie with heart and dramedy that's commercial and accessible, and a heavy portion of substantial critics will respond to it too, you know. And it's not going to be everyone. Some are going to come after it because they can't have to, but that's been rewarding too. Not because I care about that stuff very much, but because I care about that stuff for what it means for the film, if that makes any sense.
Sure, it makes perfect sense. What do you think you took away from, because you've worked working in animation, you know, maybe it helped you deciding whether you wanted to use storyboards, and B, you've had some great directors direct some of your work.
Yeah.
What have you learned? Were you there always absorbing because you wanted to do this one day? And what were some of the things you were able to bring to this?
Well, I've got to work with some very cool directors too, and I've always had a fair amount of accessibility and, like, kind of being on set all the time. John Lasseter was kind of my first boss. I mean, literally, that was my first job as a screenwriter, was working on Cars that John was directing. And so, you know, obviously it's animation, but you learn so much from him. And so you pick up things, like, and then you go, you do your next movie, and you go, oh, you know what I like is the way that person works with actors. And I like the way that person works with his crew. And I like that way that person is not actually so, I don't like how that person is kind of like, all decisions have to go through them. I like that the way that this person, she inspires people to kind of come up with their own thing, and then that creates a really cool environment. You know, and so you pick up bits and pieces, so you're almost forming the type of director you're going to be before you actually get to direct your first film.
That's great. Yeah. So it's like going to film school, but on set.
Oh, that's kind of what I describe, but I don't know. I don't have the technical jargon, and I don't have the know-how, many things. I just did a film that I produced with this director who blows me away. His name's Alfonso Gomez-Rejon, and he directed this movie. It's that one all of Sundance, Me and Her Own, The Dying Girl.
Right,
and
I read about it.
I produced it, and he directed it. I'm blown away by this guy. Like, I geek out as a fan over what he knows and is capable of doing. And I mean, the way he hired his DP was the original director of the DP of the Korean Old Boy. He barely speaks English. He had to use an interpreter. And Alfonso is confident enough as a filmmaker on the filmmaker side of the level to work with a DP whose work he admires to tell a teen cancer movie. I mean, the guy is so technically proficient and knows how to tell a story that I'm just like in awe. But I'm not that. I don't have that. Alfonso didn't just grow up on sets. He grew up directing Second Unit. I admire people like that, and I also recognize what I don't know and try and hire people around me to cover for that.
It's a smart move.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what's next? Do you have something else you're...
I'm writing some stuff. I'm writing one that Bradley Cooper's attached to right now. I'm just finishing writing. I'm producing the movie, Me and Her All, and yeah, I'm just figuring it all out right now. Okay. It's kind of, I'm trying to figure out what I want to do next. It's hard. I did an Al Pacino movie. I don't know what to do.
All right. How do you top that?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I really enjoyed your work. Good to meet you, man.
Thank you.
Did you enjoy the interview with Dan Fogelman?
Very much.
He's an interesting guy. It's kind of cool, you know, because, you know, you do your first film that you're directing and you got Al Pacino. It's kind of cool.
First live action. He comes from a lot more cred, though.
No, he's definitely got cred. I mean, you know, he's had some big money-making films, but he's never directed before. This is his first
time. No, dude. It, you know, everybody always wants to, you know, you just never know. Project reads good, you know. Take a chance.
Joe, you have a story.
Which one?
The first one that you got there.
How do I know which the first one is?
All right, how about the husband with the wife?
Husband claims his wife is nagging him from beyond the grave about her slippers.
Please explain that one.
Every week at 1:15 p.m., Chris Taylor calls WBAI and complains that his... a henpecked husband claims he is still being nagged from beyond the grave
Ted Weisserman, 79, claims he is being browbeaten from the spiritual plane.
Browbeaten from beyond the grave.
Yes, by wife, fiery wife, Yvonne. But he says he's over the moon that his wife is still finding time from the other side to give him an ear bashing. The former, I don't get what the lollipop man said.
It said former lollipop man?
Yeah, the former lollipop man.
The former lollipop man. Lollipop man. I'm sorry.
Says he has received the hair dryer treatment via a medium.
A former lollipop man.
He said Yvonne issued a very blunt message to her hubby through the clairvoyant. You're wearing my slippers. Take them off now. There you go.
Former lollipop man wears dead wife's slippers.
There you go. Foot fetish from beyond the grave.
Maybe it's his guilt. Maybe it's guilt. He just feels guilty that he's wearing his wife's slippers.
And maybe his hearing aid. He needs to replace the batteries.
I don't even know, you know. Why does he think it's become... Why did he go see a medium about that?
Doesn't say. Does not say. I'm trying to find some logical, but they're very nice UGG, like, slippers. Maybe
are they UGGs? He's wearing UGGs?
They look UGGs. Maybe he should have just buried her with them. What do you think?
You know, I think that, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what to think. All right, we haven't go to the other story there. Not the this one. This was just an interesting story that I just, you know, I could see Chris having video of it.
Wild rhino kills woman, chases people into Paul Street. This is from UPI.com.
A wild rhino. Imagine that, a wild rhino running in the streets.
A woman was reportedly killed Monday in the southern region of Nepal after she was gored by a wild rhinoceros, which wreaked havoc on the small town of Hiduta, the town about 50 miles away from Nepalese capital of Kathmandu, was literally run over by a massive animal. News report says the rhino even entered buildings such as a hospital, bus station, and a local market. The animal also appeared to chase motorcycles in the street.
Well, damn.
There was a riot.
Wasn't that a plot from, what's the one with the animals where they escape? Madagascar?
Oh, yeah. That's,
Chris Rock.
Madagascar.
As the rhino. No, and so,
No, Chris Rock was not the rhino.
Oh, no, he was, he's a giraffe. Or, no, he was, what was he? The donkey? No, that was Eddie
the
Murphy.
The zebra.
He was a zebra, right? Was it Queen Latifah or,
it was the hippo.
Jada Pinkett?
It was the hippo.
Was that Jada or?
It was Queen? Jada.
Yeah.
And what's his name? From Friends was the giraffe, Melman. What was his name?
Michael, what's his name?
No, it wasn't Michael.
Jason.
And Ben Stiller was the lion.
Stiller was a lion.
Mm-hmm. And then,
Who plays a rhino? Paul Giamatti.
There was no rhino.
Paul Giamatti.
There was no rhino.
As the rhino.
No rhino. And then it was King Julian was played by, what's his name? Who plays Ali G?
Right.
You know who I mean.
He's married to that girl.
He was the one who played the barber in...
Borat.
Yeah, what's his name? He played the King Julian.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, a special remix. Now, this is the story that really really got me, okay? You ready for this, Chris?
Yeah, I'm just, did you want the answer as to who the actor was from Borat? Sasha Baron Cohen.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Sasha Baron Cohen. Yeah. Okay, there it is. Chris knew. Chris knew.
Well, I thought that was a bizarre movie.
I think all his movies are kind of bizarre. Okay, here, you know, this is a story, you know, when you read the Daily News, you know, they I guess the Post is the same way. They kind of group
that's
all.
The Daily News?
This is the Daily News, and it looks like the Post. They group all the stories, you know, the racially biased stories we were talking about, whether racism can be, you know, cured and whatnot. And here's what's interesting.
Is that
okay.
like they can cure the gays, they can cure the racist?
Well, yeah, there it is. They thought they could. All right, so, you know, I can't really even see. Can I see with this?
They have a pill now. If you take a pill, it completely erases racism from it.
There is e-racism pill. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. More paintball bias. Hittite versus Hasids. Okay. Wait, I can't read this. I need to get my other specs here.
Are you wearing glasses now?
No, but I have my contacts in. I can't read a thing with my contacts
in.
Okay.
You know, Borat made like $260 million.
I know. It's pretty ridiculous. Okay, now I can read. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, this is Professor Lightbulb again.
Professor Lightbulb. What were you going to tell us, Professor?
Professor Lightbulb. Hey, Professor Lightbulb, what's happening?
I got to remember that one. Hey, you know, all I know about Chitty Chitty Bang Bang is I read the book when I was a kid, and I actually made the fudge.
Did you? Or like they had an appendix. Pots here?
They had an appendix in the back, and it had a fudge recipe. And I made the fudge. Was a very good fudge.
I'm making fudge right now.
You know,
I am.
What Mike was talking about with the black kids getting shot by the police, you know, that doesn't have to happen. Because you know who Franklin Graham is?
The Franklin Graham.
He's the son of Billy Graham.
Okay.
And he made a Facebook statement, and this completely solves the whole problem of black youth being shot by police.
Wait, what was his Facebook statement?
He says, "Listen up, blacks, whites, Latinos, and everybody else. Most police shootings can be avoided. It comes down to respect for authority and obedience. If a police officer tells you to stop, you stop. If a police officer tells you to put your hands in the air, you put your hands in the air.
All right, I get where this is going. Wait. Okay, so I get it. You know, if your experience with police officers is that they're peace officers, they're there to help you, and hello, sir, and how are you doing, sir? Of course, that's your perspective on police officers. But if police officers treat you like you're a piece of garbage, and their brethren kill you, and they get off, you know, you have more antagonism towards them because you know they have antagonism towards you, and it is a vicious cycle. So,
respect goes both ways, right?
All right, yeah, but so what was your point of reading this ridiculous, fatuous thing?
Because it was ridiculous and fatuous, so I thought you might think it was funny. So
we thought we might enjoy the fatuousness. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Utter fatuousness.
Well, this guy is like an extremely respected evangelical leader.
All right, I have one problem with the statement you made.
What's that?
Respected and evangelical.
Ooh. Look at Joe.
I mean, he calls himself a Christian, but he ain't.
Listen to me. The Catholics, 600 years of the Spanish Inquisition, they called themselves Christians. You know what I'm saying?
The Crusades.
The Crusades. That was some humor and suffering over there in the name of God. So, hello.
Okay, that was some complex.
That was some intenseness.
You're getting a little baffled now. I mean, that was some complex historical.
Yeah, whatever. I'm sorry.
I'm just saying, it wasn't the Spanish.
No one expects the Spanish
Inquisition. Listen, man, we're still living the Spanish Inquisition. We are, man.
Whatever
Take a
that
look.
Means. Chris is living in the middle of the Spanish Inquisition. All right, so can I read my story now? Can I read my story?
Is Joe still there?
Joe's still here. He's still here. Amazing.
Yeah, Joe, can you give your, the name of
phone
your
number?
Internet? Yeah, your, internet. and your thing and the name of the name of the website.
The website.
It's fearsmag.com. FEARSMAG.com.
And can you give me your phone number?
No, it's not going to happen.
Phone number. He'll give you his phone number too. You can call him.
And what's your astrological sign?
I don't have a pin. Skip the phone number. Just give the internet.
Fearsmag.com. Fearsmag.com.
Yeah.
Everything genre. It's and it's from Joe.
Everything genre. And Joe, spell your last name.
Spell your first name.
S-M-I-T-H.
Yeah. Spell your first name, Joe.
Yeah.
How do you spell Joe?
J-O-S-E-P-H.
There you go.
Did you see that Al Pacino charged $40,000 to fly people on his plane? Did you see that?
Did I see what?
Al Pacino's offering to fans $40,000 and you can fly on his private plane.
Well, he's got some bills to pay. What the
hell? That's what it says here.
I'd be with that.
Hoo-ha!
Hoo-ha!
You got $40,000, you can fly on my plane.
Hoo-ha! Hoo-ha Airlines.
Can you imagine that?
You know what I watched the other night?
Flying. And I'm going to take you high.
You know what I realized I'd never really
and
seen?
And Beverly D'Angelo, my not wife.
Stop.
She's going to serve cocktails. Hoo-ah!
You know what I finally saw? And I
She makes a mean gin and tonic. Hoo-ah!
I watched The Godfather and Godfather Part 2. I'd never really seen them.
No?
You never watched them? What?
Never really.
You
no,
film Philistine, you.
No, I watched it. It was pretty amazing. So, can I read my story about the paintball and the seats?
I can't tell Al Pacino and what's the other guy's? Robert De Niro. I get those guys confused.
I understand.
Like, I can't say one movie that was one guy and not the other guy. You know what I mean?
Right. Pacino mumbles less when he's not intoxicated than De Niro.
Stop.
Okay.
That's how you tell them apart.
If you want to tell them apart,
Jeff Daniels and Bill Pullman. Can you tell them apart? Are you ready?
Mm-hmm. You see the movie Heat. If you watch the movie Heat, you can tell them apart.
Yeah, they were both in The Godfather 2 also. More paintball bias. Hittite versus Hasids. Two Hasidic teens were shot with paintballs in a possible hate crime in Brooklyn. The second attack of its kind in a week, police said Sunday. Two 13-year-olds were with their grandfather on Morton Street near Juliana Place in Williamsburg when one was hit in the ankle and the other was hit in the thigh and the arm by the paintballs at 9:50 p.m. Saturday. Cops said neither boy was seriously injured. On March 22nd, a 37-year-old Hasidic man was blasted in the beard by a paintball as he walked by on Kent Avenue near Hughes Street on his way to synagogue around 7:30 p.m.
I lied. I was just going to the rave, I wanted to put the color in my beard.
No, wait. Here's the best part. Here's the best part. This is the best part. This is the best part. Stop yourself. This is the best part. Cops were investigating both attacks as possible cases of paintball persecution, but they were not immediately clear if they were linked. And I had to look that up. Paintball persecution? What the hell is that? Is that a new thing? Paintball persecution?
Paintball is a crime now? Paintball is a hate crime now?
No, paintball persecution, son. Get with it. They just and I looked it up. There is no such thing as paintball persecution. But they just threw that in there casually. Cops are looking into it. See if it's paintball persecution. Joe, come on. Help me here.
Blame it on the media.
Paintball persecution. So, Chris, have you been a victim of paintball persecution yourself?
No.
See?
Maybe painted balls persecution.
Stop. Be nice. Be nice. Don't make...
Oh, you know, Joe, I have aluminum underwear, so you can't...
Exactly.
That's you know, people throw stuff at me when I'm waiting at the bus stop. Sometimes it's like milkshakes or beverages from a fast food place.
It's because of the beard, man. You got to shave the beard, dude.
You got to change your
wardrobe. It's my own fault. I know. It's my own fault for being...
You know, and you got to get rid of the aluminum hat when you go out. If you're going to be Professor Lightbulb, like
He does.
You can't wear
Chris,
the hat.
You know, your phone, you need to get a new phone.
What do you mean I need to get a new phone? What's the matter with
you? Because you sound like crap. You sound like you got your DK 1000. DK standing for Distortion King.
Really?
Yes. Oh. You do. You used to sound good on your landline. Your landline sounded better. You don't have a landline. Do you have a landline anymore?
I have a landline, but I need to know which phone to buy that I want. You know, remember that guy that called like 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago?
No.
And he had a great sounding phone?
Yes.
We got to find out what phone he has. And
no, he had
out.
A good phone. That was a great phone.
I got to find out what kind of phone it is. Because it's like, you know, every phone out there now, you try to buy a phone, it's crappy. We need to find out what kind of phone he has. What was his name? He was living in Harlem or something. his name was Professor Pastrami or something like that, or I don't know what it was.
Dr. Phony. No, I don't remember what his name was, but...
But you are Professor Lightbulb. I think that's great. I think that's a great name for you, Professor Lightbulb. I think that's great.
Joe?
You.
Joe?
You're Professor
Yes,
Lightbulb.
Mike.
Joe, you're Professor Lightbulb. All right, could you go to the next story, Joe?
Mike
because
is
I have another one. Listen,
you have more stories? Oh, it just goes on. I want to talk about, Mike, what did you do this week, man? Forget about the story.
Chris, take a number. Chris, now serving number 22. Christian number is 85.
You know, both of you guys must have done something interesting. You know what
Chris,
I mean? Like,
Chris?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I was on.
You
I was
got
on,
cold cuts?
I was on, they did a TV spot where I had to talk, ironically, I had to talk about Trevor Noah taking over for Jon Stewart and my thoughts on it. The irony, of course, is I never watched, you know, the show. And I didn't even know who it was. But I boned up on it.
You know where I went last week?
Where'd you go?
I went to see Larry Wilmore.
Yeah, you told me. How was that?
Larry Wilmore was great. I like Larry. He's a very personable man. I actually got to talk to him for a couple of minutes after the show, and he's a good man. I like Larry Wilmore. I think he's
Are you familiar with Trevor Noah?
Yes, I've seen him on The Daily Show.
And what do you think? Do you think he'll be a good successor to Jon Stewart?
No.
I do.
There's two other people I think would be better successors.
Who? Samantha D?
Samantha B.
B, I'm sorry. Or Jessica Williams?
Or Jessica rocks. Jessica is amazing, although Samantha Bee is a little bit more commercial. She's got.
Aren't you impressed that I know these names?
I know.
I've boned up.
Samantha
Bee
could be
people,
like the Barbara
but
Walters.
But I know all about them.
She could be like the Barbara Walters. Or,
you know, Craig Kilborn only did it for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Or Jason Jones could have taken over the show, too.
And many graduates of Daily Show have gone on to have their own show.
Well,
Samantha Bee.
John Oliver
takes over.
Is amazing.
Show. He's on the nightly show. And
no,
Samantha
no.
Bee. What?
Larry Wilmore.
That was a nightly show. What is Samantha? John Oliver. He's
John
on
is last week tonight.
Last week tonight
on HBO.
On HBO. And what's her name? Samantha D is on TBS.
Mm-hmm.
See, look at that. Look at that. And I don't even have a TV.
Jon Stewart.
What?
Who produces Jon Stewart?
He does.
He produces himself.
And
he...
the Worldwide Pan? Doesn't...
No. This is Comedy Central.
Mm.
So go ahead, Joe. You have another story.
That's all you did. That was your interesting thing. Well, I wanted something cool.
And I saw Bjork at City Center.
Oh, how was that?
That was very good.
Did you sing the song from The Professional?
No.
Well.
But I actually enjoyed the first half of her show more than the second half.
Second
but,
half?
Yeah, well, because it was more of an avant-garde interpretation of a modern classical themes. And there was this whole audiovisual thing going. There was a whole, like, visual thing going on and this costume that was very reminiscent of spring. And it was very good. I found it very moving. I would. She's in town for a couple of more performances, and I would highly recommend.
Oh, I know why you went. I figured it all out.
Why?
I figured it all out because you know you hooked her up.
What do you mean I hooked her up?
You know, you hooked her up with your gig. You know, like what you do.
What?
Maybe not.
He thinks you do her travel.
Not really.
Oh, okay. I just figured you did her travel. You
know? No. She just likes
me. That's all the exciting. I mean, like, did you guys like meet somebody like famous, Mike? Didn't you do something like, come on, something cool? That's like, as you guys have exciting lives, you're in New York. Like, what are you doing? Like, what?
I know, you're trying to live vicariously. So agricultural waste could be useful as a biofuel. Let me tell you. This story you have here, there was a whole piece on NPR this week where they were taking the waste from New York, the sewer waste,
mm-hmm.
and they were sending it out to Colorado. They were processing it, and they were using it in the wheat fields in Colorado. Not only did it increase the wheat production by 20%, but without adding any chemicals to it, there were certain parasites that would attack the wheat
that were not attacking the wheat when they were using the recycled human waste as fertilizer. And what happened was because it cost too much to ship the recycled waste out to Colorado, that the program was...
To ship the recycled waste.
Yes, to Colorado, that the program was stopped. Which was, like, mind-boggling. And now they just put it into landfill.
So the waste is, like, $4 a gallon? Is that what it costs?
Well, no, it was what it was, but the problem was that the cost to ship it by rail from New York to Colorado outweighed the benefits once the government subsidies were gone.
Oh. I'm surprised they didn't use Colorado waste. Maybe they'd be using it all up anyway.
Yeah, but Colorado doesn't have the intense saturation of population that we do here in New York.
Oh, because of all the people living in New York throwing all their stuff in the toilet and doing whatever they do in the toilet.
Yes. Doing those dookie housers. Mm. But, so, yes, you know.
Well, no, but this is not about human waste. Get to the story.
Yes, it is. It says agricultural waste, so biofuel. So, yeah, but even this whole thing.
Straw.
I saw a thing tonight.
It's the Rumpelstiltskin effect.
I saw it in this movie, The Survivalist. He took birch bark, and he put it in a can, and he heated it, and then it cooled.
And he made birch beer?
No, he made an oil out of it that he used to fuel his lantern kind of thing. So,
wow.
Yes, there's all these untapped.
Well, then read us something. Teach us something here, son.
The print is very small, and I don't have...
Yeah.
So straw-powered cars could be a thing of the future thanks to new...
Who's driving that? One of the pigs? The three little pigs? The straw car?
Actually, it's the big bad wolf to get around from the houses.
No, the straw car, the brick car.
There you go.
Car made of mud.
A new study pinpoints 5 strains of yeast capable of turning agricultural byproducts such as straw, sawdust, and corn cobs. Yeah, I knew about the corn cobs and the sawdust.
I love
into talk. Bioethanol, a well-known alcohol-based biofuel. Yeah, that's the ethanol we put in the gas kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, corn cobs.
Okay.
Mike's favorite.
So, which could also be turned into pipes, which...
Straw.
There you go.
Turn straw into gold.
It is estimated...
That's according to Professor Lightbulb there.
It is estimated that more than 40 billion liters of bioethanol could be produced each year from crop waste. There you go.
Mike makes crop it so waste. You can't even read it, so you sound really intelligent because he gives you ones without the printing. So when you read it,
or when the ink's starting to run out.
All right, can you read this one, Joe? Can you read that one? Can you see, Joe? Can you see?
Mike, you can't read it either. You got to put on your special glasses. The Listen. One with the big...
Yes, the magnifying glasses.
I think there's something going on here. I mean, how can you say senior citizens increasingly satisfied with their sex lives when senior citizens have very relative debilitated short-term memories?
It doesn't matter. They're satisfied or what they can remember.
Mike, did you send in your AARP thing yet?
Not yet. I got 5 years. Sorry. Good, Joe.
Dude, they bombard you, man.
Yeah, I've heard it in about 3 years. I'm going to start getting those letters. Good.
3 years.
Good.
This past year, he got 3 letters. Read into that.
Good, yeah.
He's older than me. I know that, so I know what the deal is.
In your mind.
Huh?
In your mind.
I've done your travel. I've had your birth date for the TSA.
Only intellectually.
Listen, you got the Grecian formula tonight.
We go ahead.
The gray eyelashes are coming out.
Thank you.
Oh, man. Mike, where are we going? Where's the trip, man? Come on. Get us a trip, Joe. Where can we go cheap?
At Mike's age, it's a cruise. It's a floating senior citizen home for him.
Thank you.
Oh.
This way, you know.
Listen, Joe,
he could have the buffet at 4. He's into bed by 6. They're gonna have the Lawrence Welk polka music. So they're gonna have some old school rap.
Is there any good cruises? Is there a good cruise to go on? What's the best one, Joe?
Yeah. Stop with the cruises, Joe. Give me the story. I want to know the damn cruises.
No, I want to know. Joe has to know what the good cruises are. That has to be a good cruise to go on.
Alaska.
Is that the good one? Yeah.
See it before it's gone.
Yeah.
Wow.
I've heard.
Senior citizens have experienced a considerable improvement in their sex lives since the 1970s.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Are you speaking from experience?
From Cialis.
No, it just makes sense. It makes sense, doesn't it?
There you go. Listen, you farm. You can leave the farm animals alone, Chris. That a doctoral thesis by...
By Professor Lightbulb.
Caraticus Potts.
At Shengesheki Academy has found that... It's S-E-N-S-H-E-K-I Academy has found that 6 out of every 10 women and 7 out of every 10 men over 70 are highly satisfied with their sex lives. Based on data from the large age 70... and women's population study, researchers at the University of Gutenberg for the aging and health.
After you hit 70, you realize less is more.
There you go. Have examined the sexual attributes of senior citizens and identified the factors that determine whether or not they remain sexually active. There you go. There it is. What more you want? I don't know. So, pop the little blue pill.
Say moon pill?
Blue pill.
And what happens?
We can have a good time. So.
The blue pill, Mike. You never took the blue pill?
I'd like to know what you think of this show, because you've been through a couple marriages, but you're happy now. Just slip out the back, Jack. Are humans hardwired to break up and move on? A St. Louis University research review article suggests people are hardwired to fall out of love and move on to new romantic relationships, Chris. Our review of the literature suggests that we have a mechanism in our brains designed by natural selection to pull us through the very tumultuous time in our lives, said Brian Botwell, PhD, Associate Professor of Criminology and Criminal Justice, and Associate Professor of Epidemiology at St. Louis University. It suggests people will recover, the pain will go away with time, there will be a light at the end of the tunnel. Botwell and his colleagues examine the process of falling out of love and breaking up, which they call primary mate ejection, and moving on to develop new romantic relationship they call secondary mate ejection. Drawing largely upon the field of evolutionary psychology, they say that men and women might break up for different reasons. For instance, a man is more likely to end a relationship because a woman has had a sexual relationship with another man. For evolutionary reasons, men should be wired to try and avoid raising children that aren't genetically their own, the authors say. Men are particularly sensitive to sexual infidelity between their partner and someone else. That's not to say that women don't get jealous, they certainly do, but it's especially acute for men regarding sexual infidelity. On the other hand, a woman may be more likely to break up if her partner has been emotionally unfaithful, partly because of the evolutionary reasons. Over the deep time of evolution, natural selection has designed mate ejection in females to avoid the loss of resources, such as help in raising a child and physical protection that their mates provide. Sometimes both men and women end a relationship for the same reason. For instance, neither gender tends to tolerate or value cruelty on the part of their partner, Botwell said. In addition, some people might be more than likely than others to fall out of love or have problems moving. The ability to break up and find someone new to love lies along a continuum influenced by environment and genetic factors.
Is that the love-sex continuum?
It is the love-sex continuum. Brain imaging studies of men and women who claim to be deeply in love also provided important clues about dealing with breakups. Functional MRI showed an increase in neuronal activity in parts of the brain, the pleasure areas, that also become active with cocaine use. So love is like cocaine, Joe.
Give me a couple of lines, and I'll call you in the morning.
There it is. Love is like, love is a drug. Who did that song? Helen Fisher's work has revealed that circuitry in the brain, which is deeply associated with addictive behavior, also is implicated in the feelings associated with romantic attraction and may help explain the attachment that often follows the initial feelings of physical infatuation with a potential mate. Think of it as that initial feeling of falling in love when you want to constantly be around the other person, almost in an addictive way. Falling out of love about what contains might be compared to asking a cocaine addict to break his or her habit. To sever the bond or move on is a huge ask of a person. Ultimately, trying to move on from a former mate may be similar in some ways as to attempting to break a drug habit. What's your thoughts here, Joe? Should I finish? Building off the drug addiction analogy, Boutwell examined studies about the brains of former cocaine addicts to try and predict how brains of those who are breaking a relationship habit might look. There it is. Joe, did you feel like you were quit kicking cocaine?
What?
Did you feel like you were kicking cocaine when you broke up with your girlfriend?
What do you mean? Yeah. No. What girlfriend?
Wife.
Yeah, what girlfriend, Joe?
No, that was a survival instinct.
Yeah.
That was not about... That was not kicking a habit. That was like, you know.
You want to live.
I want to live.
I want to live.
And what about you, Joe? I mean, Joe. Chris.
What about you, Joe?
You, Chris. What about you? You're a heartbreaker. You break up with women all the time. How do you do it? Exactly. You can't answer.
How do I do what? Break up with women?
When you break up or when you get broken up with.
He's a heartbreaker. Mm-hmm. Deal breaker.
You tell me about some girl that broke up with you and then she tell you that song to her.
Oh, she told me I was that song. Joe, you know that song?
You're just somebody I used to know.
I'm somebody. Mike, you remember all these things. Yeah, she said, I'm now that person. I'm that guy that she used to know.
Mm-hmm.
Then she calls me back. I mean,
Still to me like this guy I used to know because I don't see you anymore. So
I should just play that song.
You're just voice in over the airways.
Calling from the bunker. But you know what's interesting? I saw on it was going through the
this
internet.
This is Chris Little Adolf. He's calling from the bunker.
And
how's Maria Braun these days?
You know those things like Hawaii 5-0. Where are they now? You know how they have those things.
No,
Hawaii 5-0.
Where are they now?
Yeah. Well, they do that.
Are you McGarrett or Dano?
No. So that's what the segment was. It was like Hawaii 5-0, where are they now? This was like 2 days ago. I was like, click on it, and I looked to see where all the actors are. They're all dead. Every single one of them is dead.
So, Chris, I have to ask you, being you live in a bunker, so when you meet Maria...
You live in a bunker watching Hawaii 5-0.
When you meet Maria, and you get married...
Yes.
So before you go to bed at night, are you going to give the strychnine tea and then take the Luger bullet in the morning because you're such a romantic and you know how to do a killer honeymoon?
No, you know what it is? Like Mike has the music playing, like that's the perfect music, Mike. Yeah.
Mike is...
Hey, baby. Like, I'd be like, hey, baby.
CPR? Put your hand up. Hands up. Hands up. Hands up.
Well, all the women I meet now are all married.
They look at you and they tell you that they're married, or you see a ring on their finger. It could go either way.
They tell me they're married. They're like, hey, I'm married. Like, yeah.
Yeah, like you're talking to them 5 minutes, and all of a sudden you see them sneak their rings back on their fingers.
That's the line they use.
Hey.
At a certain point, you know you don't got game when every woman you meet is married.
Yeah.
Hey, you're a nice guy. The line is, you're a nice guy. I can't do this to you. I'm married.
Yeah. Well, Mike, isn't that the truth? What's your name? What was that critic's name? And I said, hey, she's really hot. And Mike said, yeah. And then Mike talked to her. You know, because Mike goes in on my behalf. And she's like, yeah.
Mike was pimping for you?
I have a boyfriend. That sounds like that's what she said. Remember that, Mike? She's a boyfriend. So if they're not married, they have a boyfriend. Everybody has a boyfriend now or they're married. I live in a sad life. Yeah. I spend most of my time listening to the radio.
It's a hard knock life for Chris. Everyone is married since he's walked into the bar. He doesn't get so far. It's a hard knock life for Chris. He keeps getting dissed by this.
What did you guys think of the Scientology movie, the new one?
I haven't seen it yet. I know it aired on Sunday night. I have to watch it.
Mike didn't see it either. Oh, well.
But I'm sure it could change your life.
I sure can, you know?
There you go. Either Scientology, Mormonism, Unitarianism, left-wing alien Zothra-ism, or, you know.
Mothra-ism?
Mothra-ism, Godzilla-ism, elephantism.
Spartacus-ism.
single white guy living in a bunker upstate New Yorkism. Hey, I'd like to see him come and take a look at my hole in the ground. Where do you live?
Hole in the ground, a dweller seeking same.
Wait, isn't he, doesn't it make him a, wow, Chris is a Morlock.
Exactly, Chris is a Morlock.
He's a Morlock.
He's looking for, Morlock looking for Eloy.
I'm a Morlock looking for Eloy. And I have that, I just play that all clear sound, you know, the alarm.
Morlock. All right, hello, you're on the air.
We're on the air?
Yes, you're on the air.
The Who's air?
This? The air.
The night shift air?
The night shift air.
People?
Yes.
Jeff.
It's Jeff. Jeff.
Hello.
Did you cook up the guitar, Jeff?
The drum set's right here waiting. I'm in that same house. Mom and Dad both passed away.
Oh, wow.
Just me and the drum set and the guitar in the studio, and that's the, see where it goes from here. Here's what I want to say. Joe, listen, Joe.
Yes, Jeff.
Last week, Leanne, what's her name? Leanne,
That was two weeks ago.
2 weeks ago she was on. And this little nugget came out. I'm going to raise the mic. Tell me if you want to address it. Chris heard it too. Somehow it inadvertently came out. Mike let out, he said, about women. He said, I know enough already. So Chris and Leanne were like, whoa, 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 tell us more. Mike said, that's the next show. So we didn't get back to it. But Mike, I now honor your words more than I did 25 years ago. So when I ask you now to expand on that question, when you said you know enough about women, I would love that, man.
I know enough to know better.
Sammy Davis.
There it is. Sammy Davis. How do you bring in Sammy?
I'd love to know more, Mike, man. Come on, tell us some more what you meant when you know enough about women, man.
Let's put it this way. You ever see that Mel Gibson movie?
Which one?
What Women Want.
Oh, that one.
Yeah. That I like that. I'm in that movie now.
Really?
Yes.
What do you know about women, Mike? What do you know?
I know a little bit. I've learned a few.
He knows enough that he's not with a woman right now. He's with me.
2 weeks ago?
Did I what?
Chris, do you remember that moment 2 weeks ago?
I remember every moment with Mike. You know? I mean, Mike
remembers every moment.
You and Mike have very special moments together. This is why you're going to Turtle Island together.
Turtle Island.
No, I'm sorry. There was one more piece to that.
Okay.
After Mike said that, then Leanne said, ooh, I sense bitterness. And Mike said, no bitterness. That was the next interesting thing. Leanne accused him for that statement of being bitter, to which Mike corrected the record. No, I just know enough about women, not bitter, just something else. Just knowledge. Mm.
Yes, knowledge. Ooh. Knowledge is not bitterness. I'm not bitter about my knowledge. Joe, you got a Sharpie?
Yes, I do.
All right, tell you what, the next time Leanne is on, Mike, I'm going to call up and say the same thing.
You better call up, and that's right, and Leanne will pin me to the wall.
Mike, like a butterfly.
What is this one?
Well, I can't give out wisdom about women
that's funny.
On the fly.
It's going to be like Silence of the Lambs.
Exactly.
Tell me, Clarice. Tell me.
Yes, tell me, Clarice.
Please.
I want to know what you know about
me. Here, you want the Sharpie? Jeff.
Yes, thank you.
Chris, they all got boyfriends and husbands. That was true 15 years ago for me, Chris. Hello?
Oh.
Jeff, you never got married, Jeff.
Two marriages when I was very young, and then that was it.
Like, two marriages, and then that was it.
The first wife took the pants. The second wife took the cojones. He's been a eunuch ever since.
Eunuch ever since.
A pantsless eunuch.
Yeah, but you know what, Jeff? I mean, but you can sell your house in Queens,
I like that.
Right? You can get
Chris identifies
that, right?
With
the... I do anything, Mike. Chris, the world is open to me. Anywhere I might stay here for the rest of my life, I might go anywhere. That's right.
Yeah, I'm saying, like, you could do whatever you want now. Just
be free, Jeff.
You know, real.
Jeff.
It seems too good to be true, right?
Jeff, be free. Fly.
Be free now.
You gotta fly like an eagle.
Yeah, be free, Joe. Be free, Joe.
Chris,
free, Jeff.
You got to take the needle out of your arm after you shoot up.
Like, thank you.
Listen, Jeff, you could move to California and you can get an apartment in California and you could find that hippie girl that you've been looking for.
That's right, Jeff. Listen, we're all moving to California in the next 2 years. So
she's on Medicaid. She's got an AARP card. What are you talking about?
My AARP card. I put it somewhere.
Listen to me, Jeff. What I've discovered is the younger generation now, the girls that are like, let's say, you know, 20 to 30, somewhere in that ballpark. Right. But they're open to older guys now.
I know.
It's like the generation. They're open to older guys. Older guys is a cool thing now.
It's a new thing, Chris.
So, there it is. Listen, Jeff, you got
send the men over 40.
Listen, I am in a very diverse playing field.
Let me say something else.
And if I was not in a relationship, I would not date anyone in the 20s to 30s because
really
these contemporary women in their 20s to 30s, there are very minimal few that have achieved the mental fortitude and self-awareness.
Joe, you're gaining fans. You're gaining fans, Joe.
Deserving of their age. They have gone to college and come away with nothing more than how to change the paper in a Xerox machine, put two staples in the stapler, and maybe know how to change the roll on the toilet paper in the bathroom.
212-209-2900 if you want to curse him out. You can call up Joe right now, 212-209-2900. Curse him out.
Joe?
Here's your chance.
JoeOut.com. Hashtag curse Joe out.
Kill him out. Kill him now.
No, but there are some women out there who have risen to the occasion, and you can have a very intellectual conversation, and they feel like a peer regardless of what their age is. But there is a vast majority of them.
212.
Call now. 209.
Joe, if you notice, Joe was a hippie women. See,
put
he was a
Joe in his place.
Listen, guys, all I got to say is I'm
going to give you
like
some information here, Joe.
One last thing.
What?
Mike has this whole, Chris, and then Joe, listen up. Mike has, carefully, he has a whole new attitude about age. It came out a second ago when the reference stage was made, or the AARP joke, but Mike has this thing now. You are only as old as you project, or you act, or you, it's a myth.
Jeff, the line is you're only as old as the woman you're feeling.
Listen, age is just a number.
I know.
And jail is just a place. All right, you ready?
And Anna Nicole Smith is still my hero.
Joe.
I'm quiet.
Is anyone calling Mike? Are the phone lines lighting up?
No, but Jeff hung up on himself. They were lit up.
There you go.
There it is.
There's got to be somebody out there that's got an opinion on what Joe said. There just has to be at least one.
No, it's the silent majority.
There's only three people listening, and two of them fell asleep. All right. Men who eat more fruits and vegetables with pesticide residue have lower sperm counts and a lower percentage of normal sperm, according to a new study. Researchers studied sperm samples from 155 men who were attending a fertility clinic between 2007 and 2012 because they and their partners were having trouble conceiving. And the men also answered 131 questions about the food they ate, including how often and what quantities they ate 38 fruits and vegetables.
That's true.
Hey, Chris, you got to Google this for me.
Hello, you're on the air.
There's a chemical
212-209
that's used as a hardening in plastics, and they use also
a
use
hardening
it
chemical
in, for plastics
for men
for plastics, right. And also it's the same chemical that they use on heat sensitive paper, and this is the one that interferes with the endocrine hormonal systems in the human body.
Oh yes, the ones
BP,
that can alter. Yeah,
BP. So it was really interesting because I was
in the plastics too.
Yes, I was watching this really interesting documentary on. It's called Paradise Lost: Plastics in the South Pacific and stuff. And this woman did this study where they cleaned her hand, and they took a bank receipt from the teller, and they made her hold it for a count of 10, and then they did this thing and they tested her blood and they did a light sensitive thing, and the amount of chemicals that came off of the paper
Right.
It increased in her blood by 6%.
Wow.
There it absorbed is. Right through the skin. And this affected...
Well, this is why they're going to get rid of Castro.
And it affects the male hormonal system, too, and the endocrine system, which has to do with sperm and testosterone.
Yeah, but, you know, touching money and eating fruit.
No,
you know?
It's not even touching money.
I'm just saying.
It has to do with that. And, you know...
It has to do with what?
It's like, look, I have to tell you, there's somebody we'll refer to as Marbles in my life. And first of all, she's on hormone replacement.
Hormone replacement.
Because she's at that age.
Hormone replacement.
Yes, because she's at that age. Now, if you take a pill.
Hormone replacement.
If you take a hormone pill. Okay, like estrogen.
Replacing hormones with, like, what are you replacing them with?
When you have lower estrogen levels as you get older, females, menopause.
And what do you need an estrogen for when you get older?
So you don't get the hot flashes and everything like that.
It keeps the hot flashes down?
Well, and it keeps your body regulated.
Okay.
All right, so, first of all, drinking, we have an excellent filter in our office, water filter. We have glass. We have all kinds of ceramic cups kind of thing. But yet, she buys plastic bottles every day that are filled with this chemical.
She doesn't realize that.
Right.
Help her.
And then she turns around, and because she has problems with the pills, she crushes the hormone pill. So basically what happens, instead of having a sustained release over the digestive process, she is...
Mainlining.
She is destroying the integrity of the pill. And now, as somebody who was a pharmacy major, you know that I am, was one of the side effects of estrogen replacement theory is back problems because it interferes with the cartilage and the bones and kind of thing. She had a sciatic condition to begin with. She is in intense back pain since she started on the hormone replacement therapy, which all this goes back to the earlier statement I made about people being responsible and taking charge of their own medical conditions, that she's seeing three different doctors who are prescribing different regimens of medicine, and she hasn't even bothered to look up her own condition to find out all the different side effects for all the different drugs she's taking and the possibility of interactive stuff. Then she is gluten intolerant, she has sugar issues, and she's drinking the water out of
sugar
the...
Sugar issues.
And she is drinking water
That's
out of...
That's the name of the first album.
Yeah, there you go. Out of the plastic that sit on her... She'll take a sip, and the bottle will stay there all week. She's corrupted the integrity of the bottle. We have hot and cold in the office. We have osmotic gradients where you have filtered water in a bottle that has chemicals.
So wait, how long do you give her?
Huh?
How long do you give her?
She wants to retire in 5 years. I give her maybe six, and she's in a nursing home because other conditions that she has that are genetically are going to turn around and kick in because
of
all
this
stuff.
Now, what was the point of this whole story, Joe?
Because it comes back to the whole concept. You're talking about the chemicals in the fruits and vegetables. And
it lowers your sperm.
Right, and taking and having full control of everything, what you're consuming, what's in the food you eat. You know, if you don't do that, it's going to be a victim of the current state chemical climate in America.
And that's not someplace you want to be.
Not Gary, no.
No, you're not. You have a last story there? What's your last?
Somebody called him, Mike.
There was, but they hung up.
This is, Chris, and heartbreaking moment, little girl fell as someone's dinner.
Oh, just stop.
And they got a photo there, too.
Yes, they do.
Now, tell the story. Tell the
story.
She's
petting it.
No. She's not petting it. She is petting it. She is. Go ahead, Joe. No. I put it up on the site.
It's on the site as she recognizes he sold for food. Of a child over her lost pet are her. The story is more gut-wrenching. It's clear this ghosted and ready.
The local meat vendor. Can you imagine their spot hanging...
Urban Tail or not, but I had heard, you know, where a client to work on importing shows
right.
to China into this restaurant, and they, you know, they weren't trying to communicate and over to go kind of thing. The guy's like, "Where's my dog?" And
his own dog. That
yes,
cooked it and fed it from.
Yes,
that sounds like an urban.
Being the young girl, viral on Vietnam, she allegedly spotted a local meat vendor. After it had gone a little bit perplexed and puzzled by this, maybe this is not quite kosher. traumatized her roasted dog, 5 years old, and from a dog for sale after it had been placed in a flatbed, brought back long-running discussion as well as neighboring China about the horse animal is, this is going to kill something for the spoil something and eat it.
Sport eating. I mean, where you just, oh, look,
no,
we
no.
can have
I mean,
okay,
I don't
okay.
know per se what, you know what I mean? This is in the United States, and they use owls.
Yeah, like in Russia.
Exactly. So, if you're going to, not
so
down.
You're down for.
As long as something
as long
is,
as somebody eats it.
Yeah.
They eat your pet goldfish, you're fine.
If they're cool.
The pets have you had.
I can't see much of a meal at it.
Dogs. Did you grow up with
kids? Dogs.
Like they say, oh, Joe.
Well, but she's not eating. But if somebody else ate it, I'd be like, dog, if somebody else ate
sandwich for school.
I like, I've had deer and had somebody
you shot and killed deer?
Yes.
You're a deer killer.
Well, two deer.
A deer?
A few golden sun. Your name.
Jeff still listens to the show.
He doesn't hate us anymore. Go ahead, Joe. Just, it's true. Read it.
It's but
the headline.
Since stab boyfriend.
There it is.
Well, you know, where do you get these stories, Mike?
This is
out.
You know, people are stressed out.
The wonderful world that we're living in.
Is there what world?
Yeah.
Why is you?
I was not doing Irish.
Joe, are you cooking? What are you doing? Are you going to cook some lamb?
I'm going to kill a bun.
I can make a nice leg of lamb. If I borrow it, the Joe Mobile. Mike Schleppin' himself.
The Brooklyn, Mike.
I extended it. Yeah, I think it's going to be.
I'm not coming back. Oh, no.
Back.
Brooklyn Roasters, man. I got to tell you. Brooklyn Roasters.
How far is it from you, Joe?
I'm truly late.
An hour from me.
Exactly.
So, all night. You're flying.
Will I park?
I need you to play some music. Oh, can I come and crave? I'm going to have to
be sponsored radio.
An hour to get there, an hour to
be Jersey.
WBAI.
Streaming on the web. Where? Hit you, Chris. Shut up. In bed, Chris. Back into the box. The box, Chris.
Facebook, NITESHIFN, youcan.com. You can get shave, please.
Back in the hole, Chris.
Shift. Life is like science fiction.com. You can follow, us on Twitter, TC. Cool. Yeah, I do. I have a couple.
Really?
What am I saying?
Man, I have a blush for you.
Do you ever?
I don't have it. Jeff's my
face.
Joe, you got a Facebook, Twitter?
Yeah, yes.
What's the
Twitter.com?
No, just Fears Magazine.
Fears Magazine.
But Joe, why? This is for your fans.
You're kidding me to tweet.
Like Chris.
Dude, I don't want
people call you.
You like Chris, huh?
What?
Joe's number.
I'm going to put Remember Furious 7 on you.
They've got, well, that's, we've seen. But, you know, it's okay. It's
Joe, what'd you think of Winter?
I thought it was great.
It was real. It was really 100%.
Winter Soldier. I have a Miss Chris. Stop. And one that be as willing as most women.